a bunch of BS. We're getting ready for another big dump. It's all about pump and then dump.
And they're not even assets. They don't have income. They don't have use.
I still think the bull market is intact for Bitcoin.
It is radical. It is rebellious. It's non-compliant. It's American.
Good evening. On the 31st of October 2008, a person or a collective of people under the pseudonym of Satoshi Nakamoto published a white paper titled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. In this paper, Satoshi laid down the design for a new technology and for a decentralized peer-to-peer money that had no intermediaries, no banks, and no government control. The white paper also detailed the inflation rate for Bitcoin, bringing it down to an inflation per block that is mined approximately every 10 minutes, and halving almost every 4 years. A few months later, the network launched, and since then, it's become a global asset class, with Bitcoin having a market cap of over $1.2 trillion. In 2024, after much deliberation and pushback, the first Bitcoin ETFs were finally approved in the United States. Not only were the ETFs launched, but they were launched successfully, the biggest ETF launch in history. In an environment where there's high inflation, where governments have globally extended their powers, many see Bitcoin as a tap out of the system, as a new digital gold, and as a way to tap out and protect their wealth from inflation and rampant money printing. On the other hand, there are some that believe that this is not the case, and that Bitcoin is not only not a store of value, but is a currency used for illicit activities and for the evasion of taxes. Tonight, I have the honor, but the extremely difficult task of moderating what has been dubbed the biggest Bitcoin debate in history. I've got some of the biggest names alongside me. On the one side, I've got Eric Voorhees. He's an avid libertarian, an early Bitcoin adopter, and an early Bitcoin advocate, and the founder of Shapeshift. Next to him, also for Bitcoin, I've got Anthony Scaramucci, a friend, a founding and managing partner of Skybridge Capital, a Bitcoin investor, albeit more recent than Eric, and the former spokesperson for Trump's White House. He didn't last very long.
Yeah, for 11 days.
For 11 days.
It was beautiful, though. It was 11 beautiful days. Keep going, Rick.
On the other side, against Bitcoin, I've got Peter Schiff. He's a gold bull, a gold advocate. He's the founder of Euro-Pacific Asset Manager. He wrote the book, The Real Crash, and famously predicted the 2008 housing collapse, and traded the 2008 housing collapse.
Correct.
With him, Nouriel Roubini, Professor Emeritus at New York Stern School of Business, CEO of Roubini Macro Associates, and the author of a book called Megathreats, The 10 Dangerous Trends That Imperil Our Future and How to Survive Them. Tonight, we are going to get into the biggest debate in history. We're going to debate the merits of Bitcoin and the merits of gold. But before we do that, guys, I want to thank our sponsors, because we've got two great sponsors with us that made this possible tonight. The first one, a gold sponsor, Preserve Gold. And they said that they know that a lot of people are worried about the fate of the US dollar. And now there's talk of a central bank digital currency, or CBDC, which may be coming to replace it. Now, if the governments get this right, they will have the ultimate surveillance tool. They'll be able to see what we spend, where we spend, and they'll even be able to dictate where you can spend your money. This is why more and more Americans are turning to real assets, and specifically, they're turning to gold and silver. If you want to protect your wealth against a potential CBDC, you should reach out to our friends at Preserve Gold. And you can do this by texting 0 to 50505. They'll explore the right option for you, and they'll even deliver gold or silver right to your doorstep, your IRA, your 401k, or any other qualified retirement account. Their process is super simple, and they're a BBB accredited company with zero customer complaints and hundreds of satisfied customers. As a special offer for us tonight, they'll even give you up to $10,000 in free gold and silver with a qualifying purchase of or retirement account rollover. And they'll even throw in an immediate $500 account credit if you request an investor guide today. So don't wait, text zero, that's Z-E-R-O, to 50505 to get your investment guide and take the first step in building your wealth. Again, text zero to 50505. So that's our gold sponsor. There's another sponsor. It's a Bitcoin sponsor. Well, not truly a Bitcoin sponsor, because even though we're going to talk about Bitcoin a lot today, the one shortfall that Bitcoin has is it can't do smart contracts. And that's why many developers who want to build smart contracts are actually going to Ethereum, well, at least until today. BitLayer is a layer 2 solution, which effectively brings smart contracts and DeFi to the Bitcoin ecosystem. They've just launched on mainnet, and they've got over 400 projects building on them. So if you want to check out BitLayer, if you're a developer, if you just want to check out what's going on, check them out at bitlayer.org. And with that said, I think we'll kick off our debate. Wish me luck, because I've got two very strong sides, four very strong personalities. I've been excited, I've been dreading it, but here goes. So I think to start off, let's maybe try and find the places where we all agree. And I think that the place we'll all agree is around the state of the American economy and the world economy. Specifically, we've got the American economy. You got inflation lingering. Before today's jobs report, we had jobs being extremely sticky. We've had America printing more money in the last couple of years than they've printed in their entire history. I think over 50% of US dollars have been printed in the last couple of years. On the other side of the world, we have Japan. We have Japan with now increasing inflation, with the yen weakening against the US dollar quite a bit. I'm going to hand it over to Nirul, because Nirul, I know you've got strong views here. How do you see the American economy and the economy at large? And maybe just bring it back to how you see the future.
Well, I would say that the U.S. economy is doing actually pretty well. The IMF is expecting that growth this year is going to be 2.7% as opposed to 2.5% last year. The Eurozone is expected to grow only 0.5%. Same thing for the U.K. So U.S. is going to grow four or more times faster than the Eurozone or Japan or the U.K. Among advanced economies, the strongest. Inflation was high, but it's dropped like a stone. It was closer to double digits a couple of years ago. Now it's above target. Target is 2, but it's 3%. The last mile might be harder, but guess what? Most economists, including myself, a year ago thought that in order to achieve a 2% inflation target, we'll have to have a hard landing because they had to raise interest rates. And instead, growth remained above potential. Inflation dropped like a stone. And most people now, including myself, believe there's going to be a soft landing. So it's doing okay. You know, there was inflation, but there was printing of money. Probably there was excessive fiscal and monetary stimulus. But we prevented the collapse of the economy during the COVID crisis. And I think we also got lucky in the last couple of years because there were three negative aggregate supply shocks that led to higher inflation, lower growth. The impact of COVID on supply chains, supply of labor and output, the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on commodity prices, and the zero COVID policy of China. Those negative aggregate supply shocks reversed themselves in the last year. So we also got lucky. So, it was not just the Fed that anchored inflation expectation, but reversal of these shocks led to a soft landing.
So to summarize, you think that we've actually got a soft landing, because you spoke a while ago about a hard landing or potentially no landing. You think that we've now come into a soft landing?
I think soft landing will be the baseline. If anything, rather than even a short and shallow recession, it will be a softish or bumpy landing. We may have a no landing because until recently growth was above potential and inflation was sticky. We'll see next month whether the Fed is right by saying it's only a temporary bump or whether it's really truly sticky. But either way, we're going to get a soft landing.
Peter, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you agree with Nouriel? Because you may not agree on everything, but are you going to agree with Nouriel around the fact that Jerome Powell and his Fed have engineered a soft landing?
No, I disagree with my debate partner here on the state of the U.S. economy. I don't think it's...
My whole strategy here was to get them to disagree at the onset.
We don't agree on it.
Yeah, I don't think the economy is good at all. I think it's an illusion created by statistics. I think the reason that Biden is the most unpopular president in modern history, the reason Harris is the most unpopular vice president, is because the economy is lousy. In fact, that's where Biden scores the lowest, is on the economy. I think that we're suffering from 20 years of monetary and fiscal policy mistakes. Inflation has driven the cost of living up maybe 30-40% in the last few years. As a result, American families are struggling. They're borrowing. Consumer credit or debt is at an all-time record high. Credit card debt, household debt, savings have collapsed. Americans are forced to work two or three jobs. We've never seen so much moonlighting in the United States. So people are having to give up their evenings, give up their weekends. They're taking extra jobs because there's the only way they can pay the rent, put food on the table, keep the lights on. So I think we have a very weak economy. Look at the debt. Our budget deficits are running at maybe $3 to $4 trillion a year, almost $1 trillion a quarter. Our trade deficits are $1 trillion a year. So we're hemorrhaging red ink. We're living off of debt and government spending. And I think we're benefiting from the fact that other countries are also suffering from the same monetary and fiscal policy mistakes. And that's causing people to take refuge in the dollar. So I think the dollar remains overvalued versus other fiat currencies. It's losing value in terms of purchasing power. It's losing value in terms of gold. But the fact that it's not losing as much value as the yen or the euro or the pound is temporarily, I think, propping up the economy. But I think we're headed for a dollar crisis and a sovereign debt crisis that's going to result in a massive economic financial crisis, much worse than what we had in 08, much worse than anything we experienced during COVID.
Okay, so before I move on to the other side, I mean, I just want to, what do you think the timeline is for this collapse?
Is there like a defibrillator in here? Or
timelines are always tough.
If shift causes a heart attack, I just want to make sure somebody could help us.
But no, it's always tough on the timing, because obviously these problems have been growing for not just years, decades. But I think if you just look at the rate at which, they're growing exponentially, right now we're spending $1.1 trillion a year on interest on the debt. That's more than we spend on national defense. By next year, it'll be up to $2 trillion. So interest on the debt will be more than we spend on Social Security or Medicare. And within a couple more years, just with interest rates where we are, you'll be looking at a situation where 100% of all tax revenue is needed just to pay interest on the debt, not any of the principal, but just to pay the interest. So clearly, there's going to be a debt crisis that's coming. It's relatively soon. And I think it's going to manifest as a currency crisis, because rather than defaulting, which would be, the least bad alternative, we're going to inflate. The Fed is going to go back to quantitative easing in a big way. I think we're going to print more money in the next round than in 1, 2, 3, and 4 combined. And I think the markets don't expect this right now. They think the Fed has succeeded and that inflation is headed back down to 2%. There's not a chance that that's going to happen.
It's not only the markets. Yeah. Nuriel over here said the same thing. So yes. It's not only the markets.
Prior to 2008 financial crisis, in the 40 years prior to that, we only had 3 years out of 40 where inflation even got as low as 2%. All the other years were much higher. I think it averaged almost 5% a year during those 40 years. The only reason we had 2% was because we got lucky after the financial crisis. And if you notice, the Fed didn't even invent its 2% inflation target until we were below 2%. All the years we were above it, they never had a 2% target. They only magically came up with this target when we were below it. And it was really just an excuse, a pretense to create inflation. They deliberately created inflation as a policy for a decade. And now we're living with the consequences. And of course, during COVID, those mistakes went into overdrive, because then not only did we print massive amounts of money, but we told people not to work. We told people to stay home, don't be productive, but we're going to send you money to spend. We're actually going to give you more money to spend when you're not working than you actually earned when you were productive. And so that was an explosive cocktail of inflation. And now we're dealing with the consequences.
So, I mean, I said at the onset that I want to start somewhere where we agree. Question is, do we at least agree on the state of the economy, the U.S. economy? Eric, I'm going to hand it over to you.
I find it very interesting that two obviously intelligent people who observe these financial markets disagree so immediately on even like the macro state. I think this is emblematic of the fact that the economy is kind of a mirage. And it is not a scientific mechanism that people actually understand, right? For two experts to sit here and like have completely different views on whether it's even good or bad, there's really like a deeper, interesting issue there. And so I find that kind of sad. They're not going to like disagree on whether the weather outside is like rainy or sunny. They're not going to disagree on like engineering principles. But you look out into the economy and all you see is a bunch of shadows. And I think that's largely because the monetary system is completely a mirage. And we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Well, maybe you could kick us off and tell us why you think the monetary system is a mirage. Because
I mean, I don't want to be the one, well, yes, I do, to say that the emperor wears no clothes. But the government just prints money and everyone pretends that that's where like success and wealth come from. This is absolutely preposterous. Printing money does not create wealth. And people throughout history have known this. And yet, time and again, they get bamboozled into thinking that if you just create more money, suddenly people are going to be more prosperous. It's amazing that the sham has gone on so long. And it's amazing that more people aren't like freaking out about it.
How does it end?
It ends in debasement of the currency, which we're going through now at an accelerating rate. And it ends in a bond market collapse when people realize that they're lending money to the most bankrupt organization on earth.
Being the United States government.
Yeah.
Agree with everything you said.
So hold on. So we actually do have some agreement.
Let me be the optimist for a second. And so I think all four of us are going to probably stipulate and agree that modern monetary theory does not work. Maybe Noriel, I think you would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Peter, Eric, modern monetary theory, printing
it's not
money.
Modern, it's not even a theory.
Okay,
I want to agree that modern monetary theory
doesn't work.
Is a scam.
But I want to explain it from a perspective of my upbringing, because I think it's important for people to understand, and we'll talk a little bit about politics if you don't mind. What happens is when you get wealthy, you get the collective biases of the people around you, and you insulate yourself as a result of your wealth. But if you're not wealthy and you go into neighborhoods where people are not wealthy, they see the world entirely differently than the wealthy. And so, as an example, my dad was a crane operator, so he got his money by the hour. He brought the money home. We used the money to live off. We had no assets. We did own the house, thank God. Bought the house for $16,000. The house is now valued at $783,000, according to Zillow.
Same house,
so it's pure inflation. And by the way, if you look inside the house, Carol Brady called and she wants her walnut paneling back, okay? And we had a little hallway kitchen. And I would never dishonor my dad by telling him, you guys, I grew up poor. I didn't. Grew up solidly in the middle class. However, when you inflate or debase the currency, you destroy these people because they can't catch up. You know, if Peter owns a house or I own a house, the asset will go up nominally with the fiat currency. But your labor is getting stolen from you if you don't own anything. So the $1,000 comes in. Let's say the $1,000 came in January of 2020. It's worth $760 today. Okay, just, you know, if you don't believe me, go look it up on the internet. We lost 25% of the value of the U.S. dollar in 4 years. So maybe my house went up nominally, I'm protected. Maybe my stock account went up nominally, I'm protected. But these lower and middle income people that are relying on labor, they're getting absolutely destroyed. I grew up in a blue collar, aspirational, middle class family that believed in the American dream. There's 20 to 25% of the people in this country right now that are blue collar desperational. We took them from aspirational to desperational in 35 years. Now, I believe it's fixable. And I believe that we can repair this, okay, but it would require the right type of political leadership. Both sides, this is an indictment of both parties, both sides have said, no, we don't want to fix it. No fixing of the entitlements, no fixing of the defense budget, no fixing or right-sizing of the corporate income balance sheet.
If I gave you the job, and I know you're gunning for the job, but if I gave you the job, how would you fix it?
It lasted 11 days in Washington. When I go into Washington, I break out in hives. I'm not looking for any job.
Let me make a point.
I like my job, but I can tell you how to fix it if you want to know. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's not that we lost that purchasing power. It was taken. The government took it.
Yes,
it's not like it just, inflation is just a tax.
Tell me why you say the government.
No, because the government creates inflation. The government spends money that doesn't collect in taxes.
Politicians.
And that's inflation. So when you talk about how the middle class or the people are suffering, it's because the government took their purchasing power and spent it. Because they didn't have the...
Peter is right about this. It's a form of taxation.
Inflation is a form of regressive taxation. Yeah, the government didn't have the guts to raise taxes honestly. So they did it dishonestly through inflation.
Peter's right about this. So you have to blame government
for the problem. There's only one source of inflation, and that's government.
But what about the people that said that the government did that so that we could have better streets, that we could have social services, so that we could have better health care?
Well, then they should have raised taxes to pay for it, or they should have cut other spending. But they paid for it through inflation. So if you're going to complain about the loss of purchasing power and rising prices, you got to complain about government. It's big government that is responsible for it.
You actually asked them the wrong question. Because yes, you did get the roads, and you did get the infrastructure, and you did.
How are the roads?
The roads are terrible.
I'm talking about the interstate highway system. All that stuff got built through deficit spending. but it got stolen, it got thieved from the people. Peter's 100% right about that.
So how would you fix it? We were getting into that.
So the couple of things. The first thing you have to do is you have to fix the system and the incentives for these politicians, because these politicians are insider trading. They got inside information. They trade on the stock market. They've isolated themselves in this oligarchic duopoly. Okay, how do they do that? They gerrymander. And so for those of the people listening, the politicians are now picking their voters. It used to be in a democracy that the voters pick the politicians, but the politicians go and they look at your Twitter feed or they look at your cookies. They say, okay, he's a Democrat. I want him in my district if I'm a Democrat. If he's a Republican, I want him out of my district. And so these districts used to look like geometric shapes that we could recognize in ninth grade geometry, and they now look like jigsaw puzzles. So number one, we have to end the gerrymandering. Number two, this thing called Citizens United, which nobody focuses on, is a Supreme Court case that came in January of 2010. And Justice Scalia said, if you got the First Amendment, you can spend unlimited money on political campaigns. That's your First Amendment right. We have created a separate but equal democracy. And I can show you policies from that day to today that are all slanted to the rich, corporate welfare, kleptocracy, big pharma, big military, big food. Okay, so you got to end that. You got to right size that. If you're capable of doing those two things, and that would require entrepreneurial political leadership, because the cynics out there like where we are right now. You know, Chuck Grassley, I think he's George Washington's great grandfather, right? He's been in the Senate forever. They want to have a perpetuation of this oligarchic duopoly. You got to end all that. You got to set up the incentives properly. And then you have to benchmark the spending to GDP, and you got to tell the federal government you can't go above 18%. You used to be able to do 20, but you can't go above 18%, because if you do that over 25 years, you'll right-size the budget. And we did it. We had the budget balanced in the year 2000.
So I got to disagree with some of this.
Yeah, okay, so you're, now you're
we haven't even gotten into
it. This is good. Let Eric disagree.
I'm an optimistic person. I went on a walk this morning, and I was looking at the birds and the butterflies like flying around, and it was beautiful. The sun was shining. Like, I'm an optimistic guy, but I also can do math. I can do math, and you can look at the debt of the government, and you can look at the economy and how it's growing and how it could potentially grow, and there's zero chance that this doesn't end in a bond market collapse, because there's no historical precedent, none, under which the federal government ever cuts spending other than the anomaly of after World War II. The federal government will not cut spending, and thus the debt will keep going up, and it will not be solved, and it will cause a bond market collapse, and the whole world's going to suffer for it.
Okay, but he's right. He's right about that, but it could be stopped.
Hold on. So you're saying mathematically it can't be stopped. You're saying it possibly can be stopped. I want to go back to Nouriel and say, do you agree with Eric, or do you agree with Anthony on this one?
Listen, we do all agree that the budget deficit is excessive. And by the way, it's totally bipartisan. When Republicans are in power, they cut taxes, but they're unwilling or unable to cut spending. I mean, even Trump is running by saying, I'm not going to touch entitlements because it's the third rail of American politics. When Democrats are in power, they like to spend more, but they're unwilling or unable to raise taxes sufficiently. So there is a bias towards budget deficit. That's definitely the case. I would say that I don't believe that the government is going to collapse for a few reasons, or the debt is going to collapse, we'll have default. First of all, we borrow in our own currency. If you're an emerging market borrowing in dollar, you cannot devalue.
But you can just lend out printing money.
You can use the inflation tax, and you can wipe out, like it happened for the last 2 years, the debt GDP ratio actually fell in advanced economies, because long duration fixed income gets reduced in value when you have unexpected inflation. So we can probably inflate away. Fair enough is the inflation tax, but it's a tax. Then we can discuss whether it's fair or unfair, regressive, progressive, but it's a tax. So we can have that option, not going to be a default. Secondly, if you look at potential growth in the U.S. compared to other advanced economies and population dynamics, the U.S. is not in great shape. But as I said, potential growth in the U.S. is 2%. With technological revolutions happening with AI, by the end of the decade, could be closer to 3%. Europe, Japan, unless they do reform, potential growth is going to be 1%. U.S. has a significant amount of still fertility compared to Europe and Japan. U.S. has 2.5 million people coming U.S. every year. So population is growing, potential growth is growing, real interest rates are going to remain lower because by having the exorbitant privilege of being the global reserve currency, we can borrow for longer and cheaper quite a while. Now, people
but,
say...
But wait,
people say, wait a moment, let's finish this point. People say, well, eventually something's going to collapse. It's going to collapse, you have to find another safe asset. I believe that, of course, gold can be something of that. But as Larry Summers once said, you cannot replace something with nothing. And if the dollar is not going to be the global reserve currency, he said, Europe is a museum, China is a prison, Japan is a nursing home, and Bitcoin is an experiment. You can say anything about Bitcoin has now become the dominant reserve currency of the world, even if you believe into it. So the question is, you don't believe in the dollar, but U.S. compared to other parts of the world, economically is much better. We have the most dynamic private sector. We're doing the innovations in all the technology of the future. We have a debt problem. I think at some point, like it happened, for example, in 83, when we had the Greenspan Commission for Social Security, when by the end of this decade, the Social Security Trust Fund runs out of money, and you can't even pay the benefits of the elderly without raising payroll taxes or changing the retirement age, we'll do a reform. But it's going to be a crisis of some sort that forces us to do that. So, okay. We'll do it. We end up doing the right thing when there's no other alternative, but we'll do it. Let's not talk about catastrophe or apocalypse. And
Peter,
so.
Let's be realistic. I want to give it to you.
Yeah, the first point I want to make is Nouriel mentioned that we had the inflation tax, but the bond market did not expect the inflation. And so the bond market was mispriced. Bonds lost a tremendous amount of purchasing power, and bond holders were not compensated because they didn't charge high enough interest. And the bond market is still getting it wrong. If you look at the break-evens, bond investors are expecting inflation to be about 2.3% on average for the next 30 years. Bonds are completely mispriced because they still have confidence that inflation is going to stay low. But when they lose that confidence and have a more realistic outlook on how high inflation is going to be, and then the bond market has to adjust to have 8, 10, 12% interest rates instead of 4% that we have now, that's what completely breaks the system. And you talk about Social Security trust funds. First of all, we never even actually had a trust fund. All we have is U.S. Treasury IOUs. The government owes money to itself. But as of right now, Social Security is already spending more in benefits than it collects in taxes. So from an operating perspective, it's already insolvent, and it's now selling treasuries in competition with the Treasury. The Federal Reserve is also selling treasuries. A lot of the big foreigners are selling treasuries. I'm not even sure who's still buying them. Somebody obviously is. But there's going to be a point in time where nobody wants to buy them, not at these low interest rates. And if we let interest rates rise to a level that adequately compensates lenders for inflation, we can't afford to pay, and then the whole thing collapses.
Could Japan and what's going on in Japan, and let me just iterate what's going on in Japan. You've got the yen devaluing, and you've got insurance, you've got inflation increasing in Japan.
Yes.
Japan is one of the largest, if not the largest, holder of US debt today. Could Japan be the straw that breaks the camel's back? Could they start selling back the US treasuries or divesting from US treasuries?
Well, they obviously could. I mean, Japan is suffering from the mistake that all these central banks made. They pursued deliberate policies of inflation. For years, Japan said we don't have enough inflation. Europe made the same mistake. The United States, it was all nonsense. There's nothing wrong with 1% inflation. It's not 2% isn't better. 1 is better. 0 is better than 1. And -1 is better than 0. Falling prices are better than rising prices. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that. Everybody benefits when the cost of living goes down. Nobody wants prices to go up. But governments concocted this ridiculous theory in order to justify creating inflation, to prop up overly indebted governments, to prop up overpriced financial assets. And now, Japan obviously is going to have to deal with that. Okay. And so is the rest of the world. But Japan is actually looks like it's having the problem first because of the enormity of debt. But they do have some solutions. They can sell dollars. I think fundamentally the Japanese economy is in better shape than the U.S. economy. It's just that the yen is not the reserve currency. But the dollar won't be the reserve currency forever. And we're going to have to deal with these problems.
What's going to be the alternative to the U.S. dollar?
Gold. Yeah, I don't think that we're going to go to another fiat currency. I think we're going to go back to gold because remember, before the dollar was the reserve, gold was the reserve. And the only reason gold replaced the dollar replaced gold was because it was not only backed by gold, but convertible on demand into gold. So it wasn't until 1971 that we went off a global gold standard to a fiat standard. It's an experiment that has failed. And I think the world is going to go back to gold. And that's going to be a huge problem for the United States.
Eric, tell me why the world's not going to go back to gold. Peter is convinced that when this crash, reset, whatever you want to call it, meltdown happens, he says we're going to go back to gold. Tell me why, in your mind, we're not going to go back to gold.
We might. We might. I would certainly believe that governments will be more comfortable going back to something they're more familiar with, like gold, than to use your phrase, to adopt Bitcoin or some experiment. Bitcoin is very much an experiment. So yeah, it could go back to gold. What's that going to do? I mean, the lesson of history is simply that, like, governments will keep debasing currency until it collapses, and then they'll, like, go back and pretend that they're being disciplined and responsible for a generation until they do the whole thing all over again. So if I think the more important point is that people of the world should stop trusting government with money in the first place. I mean, why is that not so patently obvious to people? I don't care, you know, what the government says is the main currency of the world, right? Like, I just opted out. I don't use any of that nonsense anymore because I don't believe government is good at money, just like it's not good at the post office or education or healthcare.
So is that fair to say that potentially you've put some money into gold as well? Because
yeah, I have some gold. I'd like some more gold. Gold's great. It was my understanding of gold that, like, helped me understand why Bitcoin was so cool as well.
Mooch, do you think that the governments are going to go back to gold?
I don't think they can go back to gold. And I'll point to what happened in 1933. The problem is the gold is too restrictive for an expanding universal economy like what we have now. So I don't think they go back to gold. But let me just make this point. It is fixable. And Noriel even wrote about this in Crisis Economics in 2010. The United States passed legislation signed by George Herbert Walker Bush called Pay As You Go. You can Google it. And it put up guardrails. If you wanted to have a tax cut, you had to find something in the budget to cut. If you wanted to increase social spending, you had to raise taxes. This is what got Bush in trouble. Some of us are old enough to remember, read my lips, no new taxes. We went into a recession because of the Gulf War. Bush increased social expenditures and then commensurately raised taxes. He set the trajectory that was followed by Bill Clinton to put the United States on a surplus. At the end of the Clinton administration, Larry Summers will tell you this, Noriel Rubini will tell you this.
I was there.
We had a $240 billion budget surplus, and the CBO in 2000, during the election, said we would have a $5 trillion budget surplus at the end of 2010. Bush wanted to give it back to the people in taxes. Gore wanted to build infrastructure and do things related to the environment. We squandered it in the Gulf after Osama bin Laden attacked the United States. My point being, it took 10 years to get it going in the right direction. Policies developed by Noriel Rubini, Larry Summers, we can do this again.
But remember,
he doesn't believe we can do it. Eric doesn't believe we can do it, but I believe we can do it.
Even the year of the budget surplus, the national debt went up. So these surpluses exist as accounting fictions. They're not real surpluses because the debt goes up, not down. But I want to ask Anthony a question. Why do you think these central banks are buying gold? If you think central banks aren't going to return to gold, why have they been buying so much?
Before we get there, and I do want to get into the Bitcoin, gold, and whether it's going to be Bitcoin or gold. But all of this stuff is making me extremely nervous and probably making a lot of our viewers extremely nervous that there could be some huge stock market crash. And it's not only us talking about it. It's big people like Robert Kiyosaki, who's a financial expert, and even former President Donald Trump, who recently warned Americans that we could get the largest stock market crash we've ever had. So this could be the alarm bells ringing. And there are Americans that want to protect their savings and they want to opt out of the system to protect themselves against government overreach, against increasing inflation. To do that, a lot of Americans are turning to physical gold and physical silver. And this is where one of our sponsors of tonight's debate comes in. If you want to protect your wealth against inflation, against government printing, against a potential collapse, you may want to text zero to 50505, and that will get you an investment guide from Preserve Gold. They make it really easy to buy gold and silver. They'll help you explore the options. They'll help you deliver gold or silver right to your door, your IRA, your 401k, or any other retirement account. They are an A-rated company with a BBB rating. They have hundreds of satisfied customers and five-star ratings across the web. And as an exclusive offer for you and us tonight, they'll give you $10,000 in free gold and silver with a qualifying purchase or retirement account rollover. So don't wait. Text 50505 today or visit preservegold.com Bloomberg.com/zero. So, guys, let's not get fire insurance when the house is burning down. Start protecting yourself now. Again, 505052 to preserve gold. All right, guys. So I see Nouriel's run away from the debate.
Yeah, from break. We're showing our age.
He's, he's selling his bonds.
He's selling
it. Yeah. Maybe $10,000 worth of free gold.
Yeah. So I mean,
that's a little fishy.
Yeah. I mean, look. I think while we're waiting for Nouriel, I guess just a reminder that we do have esteemed sponsors here tonight. So one of them is Preserve Gold. The other one is BitLayer, which is a sponsor on the Bitcoin side. BitLayer is the protocol that brings smart contracts to the Bitcoin protocol. Up until today, of course, Bitcoin has been the dominant chain, but smart contracts have always been built in Ethereum because Bitcoin hasn't had smart contracts. What BitLayer does, it's a layer two, and it allows people to bring smart contracts and DeFi to the Bitcoin ecosystem. If you want to check it out, if you're a developer, go and check it out, bitlayer.org. Or if you just want to get some interest, or you've just got interest in the space, check it out. That's bitlayer.org. So while we are waiting for Nouriel, Peter, I'm going to kick off with you, and I'm going to ask you, why do you think that it is premature or not a good time for governments to move to potentially Bitcoin?
Well, I don't think anybody should move to Bitcoin.
Tell me why.
Well, first of all, I mean, Bitcoin was created to be a digital currency, but it doesn't really work well as a currency. It's very slow. It's very expensive. There are a lot of other cryptos out there that could do that better, but the problem is most of them are too volatile to really be money, because money needs to be a commodity. It needs to be the most liquid commodity. It's not, you know, just a unit of account and a medium of exchange. It really needs to be a store of value. Now, Bitcoin is trying to reinvent itself as some digital version of gold by claiming, well, we're not going to be used as money, just like people aren't using gold right now as a medium of exchange or unit of account. They just store it as a safe haven or store of value. So Bitcoin is like that. It's just some digital version of gold. But it's not. I mean, first of all, if anything, it's an anti-gold. I mean, look at today's trading. It was a risk-on day. Everybody bought risk assets, so they bought Bitcoin. They sold gold. It does the opposite. But gold is an actual physical element. It derives its value from its metallic properties that are very unique to gold. You can do things with gold that you can't do with any other metals. It's the most valuable metal on the periodic table. It's the most useful metal. Bitcoin can't do anything that gold can do. I mean, it's no more digital gold than if I create a image of a hamburger on a computer screen. That's not digital food. It may look like food, but it has no substance. I can't eat it. And if I have a diet of digital food, I will starve, right? You can have some things. You can have digital photography, because then I still have a photograph. You can have digital music, because I can still dance to it or sing along to it. But you can't have digital gold. You can't make jewelry out of it. You can't conduct electricity with it. You can't do anything with Bitcoin that you can do with gold. There's no place in industry where you can substitute Bitcoin for gold. So gold's value is its metallic properties that don't decay over time. Gold doesn't lose its properties. It doesn't, you know, tarnish or, you know, degrade. You can leave it for 1,000 years and you can conduct electricity with it. So when I'm storing my gold, I am storing all the future uses of gold. All the whatever gold is going to be used for in the future, I've got that. I'm storing that. But Bitcoin isn't used for anything today, and it's not going to be used for anything tomorrow. I mean, yes, you can sell it to somebody if they're willing to buy it, but that doesn't mean it has any value. It means it has a price. You know, look at Peloton. You know, this week it fell to $2. It was at 170 during COVID. Was it ever worth that? Well, somebody was dumb enough to pay 170, but that doesn't mean it was worth that. There was just a price. But you can't store a price. Price depends on just supply and demand, where people want to buy it. Why do people want to buy Bitcoin? Because they think the price is going to go up. Well, what if they stop thinking the price is going to go up? Then no one's going to want to buy it. But gold has actual value. And so that's why it's a store of value. And it can be an inflation hedge because it's a commodity. It's like wheat or soybeans or oil or lumber. I mean, you can't store all those commodities. They're hard to store. So if you want to buy wheat in the future, you can store gold. And then you could trade your gold for wheat, because gold prices will rise along with other commodity prices when you destroy the value of money. But there's no guarantee that the price of Bitcoin is going to go up. It could collapse, because who knows what anyone's going to want it, because it doesn't have any actual use like a commodity.
All right, Eric.
Okay.
So, would you agree with Peter's first point that Bitcoin failed as a currency? Because Satoshi's white paper said Bitcoin. It said a peer-to-peer electronic cash system.
Look, man, I can pull out my phone and send like $1 million to Europe in 5 minutes. If you can do that with gold
at a very low cost,
if you can do it with gold, let me know.
No, but
it's never...
like, can you buy a hamburger?
Peter, respectfully, let Eric have his say. I will come back to you.
I want to delay what you're saying because it's nonsense.
Hold on.
Fine.
I want this.
Let Eric delay it first, and then you can go.
I want to narrow in on a very specific argument that you're making, which is at the root of your entire tree of belief about Bitcoin, which is that it has no usefulness. I just told you I can send $1 million to Europe in 5 minutes from my phone for like $5. That's useful. Go.
Well, you can send Bitcoin. You can't send dollars. Then somebody can sell the Bitcoin to get dollars. But I could do the same thing with 10,000 other cryptocurrencies. I can send those.
That simply proves that other coins also have value. Yes.
But how much is it worth if you can repeat it with somebody else?
Can I make a point?
One at a time. We've got four very short.
On each of the 5 minutes, the difference is that banks using SWIFT takes them 2 or 3 days because they do all the ML, KYC. The technology of SWIFT would allow you to transfer that $1 million in 5 seconds. Okay,
no.
So the reason why you can do Bitcoin, because you can have a transfer from a criminal to a terrorist, nobody's checking it.
All right.
The technology is exactly the same. You don't pay the compliance cost because you don't have the regulation. So if you had the same compliance cost, it would cost exactly the same. So it's bullshit to say that technologically you can do instantly something. Well, you can do the same thing with any bank transfer in 2 seconds.
Nero, is your argument that the reason why a Bitcoin transfer is cheaper and faster than a SWIFT transfer today is because of AML and money laundering?
Yes,
okay,
absolutely.
Eric, back to you.
Okay, banks and crypto companies, both do AML KYC, both of them, right? So what you said there is just not true. The other thing you said, which is not true, is that the reason for the delay is because of AML checks. A bank is not spending 3 days doing due diligence on its customer. These are automated systems outsourced to third parties, and I know this because I built one of these companies that actually used those things. The delay is not due to that. The delay is due to the habit and the practice of delaying payments because there's a float and a fee that banks and financial institutions make during that period of time. The dollar is a virtual currency, and you're correct that there's no reason it couldn't be sent across instantly, but it doesn't work. Because the whole financial system is just slow and lethargic and there's been no innovation in it for decades. But to the point earlier, I can send $1 million of Bitcoin in 5 minutes.
But you don't do any KYC when you do that.
You could go to somebody like BitLayer and create a KYC network.
Let's talk KYC. This is like my favorite topic.
You just send it.
Let Eric respond to the KYC.
This is my favorite topic. Okay. Okay, I'm an American, right? I grew up believing that like an individual has a right to privacy and that I'm a free and sovereign person. Why should I bow down and submit to the surveillance of a central government just to send money to someone? That's what someone would do like in Soviet Russia.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. But the banks have to because the government's rules.
We have these rules because there is money laundering, there are terrorists, there is human trafficking, there is criminals. There are lots of reasons why you want to make sure the transaction within countries and across countries don't occur for legal reason. No civilized, I know you're against any regulation, you're against government, you're a libertarian, but no civilized nation in the world, not advanced economies, no emerging market, no democracy, no less autocratic country, don't accept a world in which any terrorist, any Hamas, any Iran Revolution Guard, like they do with Binance, use Binance to transfer billions of dollars somewhere else.
Yeah, but
you may not like that world. You want to destroy every government. Go and do it. Or live in your libertarian cave. That's not the world we live in. Okay? That's not the world. And no civilized nation will accept that. Period.
Yeah, but just so you know, and I know this because I used to own a bank, but the idea that we have AML and KYC to get terrorists and money launderers, that's the pretense. The real purpose is tax evasion. Governments have very high taxes, and so the people don't want to pay. So the politicians can't say, we need all these laws to make sure you pay these onerous taxes. So they have to come up with a pretense and say, oh, it's to fight terrorism. It's to stop money laundering or drug dealers. That's a tiny amount. Almost all the efforts that banks spend is all trying to find average citizens who aren't properly reporting all their taxes. That's why we have all these laws. So, they just make up these excuses so the public will buy it.
So you're talking KYC. You're saying you shouldn't want to bow down to governments and decide. Nuriel's saying, but if you didn't do that, then you could send money to terrorists, to drug dealers, et cetera, et cetera.
Or tax evasion. You know, I pay.
Peter says it's about tax evasion and potentially tax evasion.
That's fine. I want to avoid tax evasion as well. I pay a marginal rate in New York City, federal, state, and local, of 52%. And I declare every single penny of money I make, every single penny. And that's the law. If somebody wants to cheat and not pay it, get out of this country, okay? We have laws, and actually our system of taxation is such that they should respect it. Seriously.
I think
people are going crypto in Puerto Rico not to pay taxes.
I'm
just
also a
bunch of
New Yorker and pay my full freight of taxes. But. And Noriel and I and Spike Lee will shut the lights off in that city. We're not moving.
Yeah.
But here's the thing I would say. Because I want to address the gold situation, and I want to talk a little bit about the history of money. What is money? It's a technology that we're using between ourselves so we don't have to barter. When you go throughout history, you check off boxes of what it is. Is there certainty to it? Is it something we all agree on? I brought some props here. Okay, let me pull out
the
props.
You brought us money?
I got money. Let's just talk about this. Well, the currency, but it's money. We can use it.
Well, it's a money substitute.
Okay, it's a money substitute, being esoteric. But these are Italian singles in my neighborhood. You see them? Okay. These are made out of cotton and linen. You can Google them. They're made out of cotton and linen. If we're in a philosophy class, they're absolutely worthless. Peter doesn't want to hear this, but only 5% of the value embedded in gold is for manufacturing purposes. The rest of it is the world, the global community, accepting it as a store of value. Whether we like it or not, we accept this as a store of value that's inflating 2, 3, 4, 5%. But Bitcoin's not. Bitcoin, unlike gold, has a fixed supply, and you can't make any more Bitcoin. You could get a meteor strike and have double the size of gold in the world if you have something like that. He's laughing. Let me just finish. So what he's talking about is something that we agree on that's a store of value. And what Mr. Voorhees is saying and what I'm saying is that's great and that has worked and there is value to that, but we have a new technology out there, which is a fully distributed database, a fully distributed spreadsheet among us that is immutable and unbreakable, and it's peer-to-peer. Okay, and so maybe we need a bit layer to put a KYC element around it to make sure that we're not giving the money back and forth to terrorists and things like that. But we have it, and it is scaling, and we all know at this table the Metcalfe's law and the network effect, and we know if 100 million people are using it, it has value. And when a billion people use it, it's going to have more value. And no, you can't have my money.
Okay, so
but this is esoterically worthless.
Before I forget, Bitcoin has a lot more in common with those pieces of paper than it does with gold.
Okay,
because
so,
its value comes from faith.
This is being used for 250 years.
Peter, Nuriel, I'm coming to you. Peter, would you agree with that in Anthony's first point that money is actually a technology?
No, it's not a technology. Money, yes, money did replace barter, but money is the most liquid commodity. So that's what money is. So gold was money because it was a commodity.
Technology is a tool.
Would you agree that mathematically, Bitcoin is more scarce than gold?
Well, I mean, it's scarce because it's artificially scarce. But I don't know what the difference is between a Bitcoin and a Satoshi. So people want to talk about 21 million Bitcoin. There's 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis. I mean, you can't check the whole
boxes of what we've used for 5,000 years.
But there's always other cryptocurrencies, too.
Let me make some points.
Give it to Nuriel.
Everybody talks about Bitcoin and thousands of other cryptocurrencies being currencies. One thing, they're not money, they're not currencies. If anybody knows anything about money, monetary theory, knows that something to be a currency has to be one unit of account. In the US, goods and services are priced in dollar. In the Eurozone, in euro. In Japan, in yen. Nothing is priced in Bitcoin or any other one of these pseudo cryptocurrencies. Secondly, for something to be a money, has to be a scalable means of payment. With Bitcoin, you can do 5 transactions per second. With the Visa network, you can do 50,000 transactions per second. It's not scalable. Three, for something to be a currency has to be also a stable store of value. Gold or other things, even the base metal fiat currency, is 2% per year in the U.S. Value of Bitcoin can go up by 10% one day, 20% down next day. That's why even if you go to a Bitcoin or blockchain conference, they want you to pay the conference fee in what? In fiat, not in Bitcoin, because the value of their profits can overnight disappear just because the price has fallen by 20%. So no vendor or point of sale is so idiotic to accept Bitcoin as a means of payment. It's not happening, it's not a store of value. For something to be a currency has to be a unique numerator. I have to tell the relative price of water to beef. That's why we have a dollar. In a world in which you have thousands of tokens, everyone is his own token for another goods and asset. I cannot, if you have a Pepsi token for Pepsi Cola and a Coca token for Coca Cola, you're going back, you're going back to barter. You can't even tell the relative price of two goods and services. I mean, the Flintstone and the more sophisticated banking or monetary system than crypto, because that numerator was stones, but you could tell the price of bread versus beef based on that one. Finally, people say something is scarce is valuable. There are tons of things in the world. You go on the beach, there are all these pebbles. They're worth nothing, even if they are scarce or not scarce. So scarcity by itself doesn't give you value. It has to be something of a use. And the fact that the supply of Bitcoin is fixed in the long run is a problem, because it implies there'll be massive deflation. In any economy, the supply of money has to increase by nominal GDP. If it doesn't increase by nominal GDP, you're going to have massive deflation that leads to debt deflation. Inflation is bad. Debt deflation, like we saw in the 30s, is even worse, because the real value of fixed nominal bonds or other liabilities go higher. So that's not a good system. If you have the supply of Bitcoin going up by nominal GDP, that will be something better. So that's not a good work, either one. Final point. These are not currencies. Wait a moment. Final point. No, let me finish it. These are not currencies. Even in El Salvador, when they made Bitcoin legal tender, you're forced to accept Bitcoin if you go to a point of sale and somebody wants to pay in Bitcoin. How many transactions occur using Bitcoin? Less than 1%. We have a country that forces people, Bitcoin legal tender, nobody is using as a means of payment. Even people that are in the crypto space admit that in advanced economies where inflation is 2, 3, even 4%, people are not going to use crypto as a means of payment. It's not going to be a currency. Then they say, oh, it's going to be a great store of value. It's going to go to the moon, $1 million, blah, blah, blah. But it's not a currency. Let's agree on that one, period. It's not a currency. Do you agree on that or not?
All right, Eric, I'm going to hand it over to you. Nouriel's made quite a pragmatic argument as to why Bitcoin is not a currency, wouldn't be accepted as a currency. The last point that he made was that one day we're going to get the 21 million Bitcoin that are going to be in circulation. And he says that we have to keep increasing the inflation at the rate of GDP, you say, yeah. Right?
Real or nominal.
I want you to break down Nouriel's argument as to why Bitcoin can't be a currency.
Okay, well, first, Nouriel, I'm sorry that you're paying more than half of your money to the government. Like, from the bottom of my heart.
I'm very happy with it. Because if I didn't do it, there'll be a revolution in this country. Because there's so much income and wealth inequality. I will pay even more than 52%.
The government is making it worse with those taxes.
Okay.
I was making it better off. I've been lucky to be where I am.
Let's not make this a tax discussion.
Let me say, he doesn't want to live in a barbed wire security.
Exactly.
Hold on. I want to live in a civilized world. Well, America didn't have the income tax from the birth of the Republic.
Let's not discuss that. Guys, don't feel sorry for me. They ask you whether Bitcoin is a currency.
Guys, we'll have a tax debate.
Don't change subject.
I promise you that we can get together, the five of us, and we can have a tax debate over dinner.
This is not a tax debate.
Let's have a Bitcoin debate and maybe a gold debate. Okay. Eric,
we'll do our Stockholm Syndrome therapy session later. The question at hand is Bitcoin a currency or not? We got in a lot of these debates back in the early days, like is it a currency, is it a money, and here's what, you know, Hayek said and Mises, and here's what all the government people say, and here's what professors say about what money must be. I don't really care what you call it. I can send $1 million to Europe from my phone in 5 minutes. That's all.
You can send $1 million worth.
So how do you define... Yeah.
Not the dollars.
So Eric, how do you define Bitcoin? If I would say to you, you know, we're talking about gold.
Fair.
Peter has clearly defined gold as a store of value. Nouriel has given us a breakdown for what a currency is. How do you define Bitcoin? What is it?
It's a digital commodity.
A digital commodity.
Yeah.
Can it be a... So a digital commodity, you're implying that it has a use case.
Well, Well, hold on. I should clarify. It's two things. The asset is a digital commodity, and the network, the blockchain, is a payment rail, right? It's a payment processing system. So Bitcoin is both these things. It's a digital commodity, and it's the payment processing system on which that digital commodity moves.
Can Bitcoin be a currency? Because Nouriel's made a very strong argument as to why Bitcoin can't be a currency. Can it be a currency?
I can pay for stuff with currency, with Bitcoin if someone accepts it for that thing. So, like,
why?
In a country where it's legal tender, nobody's using Bitcoin for mise en paiement. Take El Salvador. Nobody does it. It's forcing you. Legal tender.
I don't care if
why?
El Salvadorians
ask me
don't.
Why? Ask me. Answer
think,
why is not used.
What
he's saying is that... Mooch, listen, you know, Nouriel is interesting because I trained as an economist, and so I understand exactly what Nouriel's saying. He's saying that the money has to represent the assets that are in the economy. So if your productivity is going up, you have to have money in the economy to match the assets so you don't have deflation. And let's just explain quickly what deflation is to these people because it's very, very important. If you're in a debt-laden society, you cannot have deflation.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, we wiped ourselves out. We are paying back debt with dollars that are worth more than the ones we borrowed. Nobody can do that. You turn the keys back to farm equipment, turn the keys back to cars, capital equipment, and we imploded the society. We had a deflation. This is why Peter's argument will never work, because gold also has a deflationary aspect to it. Benjamin Strong said this. He was the first Federal Reserve chairman. If he didn't die, we probably would have had some laxity in the Federal Reserve leading into the Great Depression. So his argument is fallacious. It will not work. I don't believe that Bitcoin will be, because of what Nouriel just said, it will be the currency of choice where it becomes the Bitcoin standard and the global currency. Let me finish. Could it be? Eric could be right because of what he said about the blockchain. There is a payment system there that could enable it. But the problem is what Eric probably doesn't like and what I have to deal with is that we have governments and we have leftists in the country and we have rightists in the country and we have to deal with all these people. And the compromises of what they are will probably make Bitcoin not the currency of choice. Let me just finish, please. Make my last statement. But it is there. It is tangible. It has specific qualities to it that people in the world, 100 plus million people, 300 million wallets, have accepted the properties of Bitcoin. The same way for 5,000 years, people have accepted the properties of gold. And these pieces of cloth in my pocket, they've accepted it. If we're in philosophy class, these pieces of paper or cloth in my pocket are worthless. But you want it, and the maitre d's going to want it tonight when I give it to him.
All right.
Okay, and so the point is that Nouriel's correct about some things, but I'm telling you that Bitcoin will be a $1 million coin asset over the next 10 years.
We can go back
and have the debate
if you want.
That's what's going to happen.
What do you define Bitcoin as? Nouriel said it's not a currency. Eric said he doesn't really care what it is.
I think it's a store.
I defined it.
Okay, well, I think he's right. Have to remain to be seen if it could become a global currency. I think it's a store of value, and I do think it's digital gold. Nouriel and I were in Saudi Arabia debating this 2 years ago. You remember that, Nouriel?
Yeah.
You know what one of the sheikhs said to me? Hey, man, just so you know, I can't move $200 million of gold out of this country, but I can take a USB of Bitcoin and stick it up the Hershey Highway and leave with it.
I just want to point out that
it is way more portable, than gold.
On the computer.
Bitcoin, no, I understand that,
Bitcoin
but you get the point.
Is a digital
not
token.
Trusting people.
Bitcoin is a digital token. It is not a commodity in the sense that it has a use. Yes, you can send it to somebody, but that doesn't make it a commodity. It's not like soybeans or wheat or oil or cotton, but it's not a metal either. It's not gold or silver or copper. It's not a commodity in that sense. It's just a token. Digital token. It's a string of numbers that people collect, and they trade them with one another.
Say the same thing about gold.
No, if you can't say the same thing about it, you don't understand what gold is. It is a metal. And the idea that only 5% of the value comes from its properties is nonsense. But I wanted to address a point that you made. Deflation. We had the 19th century, which was deflation. The consumer price index in 1900 was half of what it was in 1800. You know, we have the Industrial Revolution on a gold standard with deflation. To say that you can't have a thriving economy with the cost of living going down.
The debt numbers and the debt ratio.
The fact that we're taking, well, that is the problem. We need a sound monetary system.
You can't have a deflation in a debt laden society.
We need to fix that.
Smart enough to know that.
We need to fix that.
You got $34 trillion of debt on a government balance sheet.
Yeah, well, that's a problem.
$60 trillion globally.
That's a problem.
Can I make an additional point? I think that at least three of us agree that Bitcoin is not a currency or money based on the definition and the four or five characteristics of what the currency should be. Is it an asset? Because people say it's an asset or a commodity. First of all, an asset has to have either a stream of income. Stocks give you dividends. Bonds give you a coupon. Loans give you an interest rate. Real estate gives you rent. Or it has to have some utility. Housing, if you don't rent it, gives you housing services. Commodity, you eat them, you use them for energy, use them for lots of production stuff, including precious metals, gold, silver, platinum. So,
gold
is utility also.
It's
also used as jewelry. It's been used for jewelry forever, right? Yes, there are these jewels made out of Bitcoin.
I'm wearing gold, just as an example.
They're so tacky, these jewelry made out, by the way, they're made out of gold, right? Those
you think Bitcoin Peter's jewelry is tacky?
So either as income, or as utility, or as use industry, be a stable store of value, has to be stable. In terms of a CPI or some index of prices, something is volatile 10% plus one day, 20% down the other day. Went from 2017, 18 to 20, then went down to 3, then went to 69, then went to 16. But now it's gone up to 70, now down to 50. Which kind of stable store value? And by the way, the suckers, as you know, we know that the users, the user of Bitcoin peaked with the price going higher. So at the peak, everybody was FOMO gets in, all the retail suckers, the whales are selling it, and when everything goes down the tube, they sell at the bottom, and they get screwed, both at the peak and at the bottom. That's the reality.
Let's address both those points.
For something to have a value, either has to have some utility, some use, some stream of income, so I can tell what's the fundamental value. For any other asset, I can do a discounted value of the use of the dividend of the income stream.
You can lend out your Bitcoin if you want to do that.
Something that there's no fundamental value.
Let's address both.
It's not a currency. It's not a currency, but it's not even an asset.
Let's address
an asset has certain features.
Let's address both points. There's two points to talk about here. One is whether or not Bitcoin is an asset. Nouriel argues that it can't be an asset because it doesn't produce an income. It doesn't produce
utility. Using industry is not the stable store
value. The second one, which I'm going to give to Mooch. So the first one I'm going to give to you, Eric. The second one, which I'm going to give to you, is around the volatility. Nouriel saying, how can you have an asset that one day is at 65,000 and the next day is at, you said 15, but...
Since a month ago, it's gone down
25%. It's currently a 60 to 80 vol asset. Okay, go ahead, let Eric talk.
So Eric, let's talk about whether or not Bitcoin is an asset. Based on Nouriel's definition, maybe Nouriel's definition is not the correct definition, is Bitcoin an asset? And what makes it an asset?
Not to invoke them, but the IRS believes it's an asset. Why are they wrong?
Listen, collectibles are also something that can go up in price. And if you have a capital gain, you have to pay taxes on it.
Address the question. So, you said it was not an asset. The IRS says it is an asset. Why are they wrong?
Whenever you have a capital gain, even on something, there's a Ponzi game. If you make a capital gain, even a total Ponzi game, you owe taxes, period, regardless of whether they're fundamental value or a bubble. There are tons of bubble. When you make money, you pay taxes period. And then you can take the taxes down when the price collapses.
I think what Nouriel means is it's not an asset in the traditional sense of a financial asset that has an income stream or a commodity. But clearly, if you own it and it has market price, it's an asset to you on your personal balance sheet. But that doesn't make it...
It's not an asset that produces a stream of income or some kind of utility.
It can. Using industry.
All right, you're saying it can.
And it's not the stable.
How?
Well, I'm in the camp where you hold it in a cold storage wallet, but you could...
Speculating that the price goes up.
You could lend it to a exchange. But
with respect, loaning an asset is not the asset producing income itself.
What are you talking about? You're loaning your money to the bank.
But that would make...
The bank gives you interest for the money that you're loaning to the bank.
Yeah, but you put your money to a real investment in some capital that earns income. So that's what the banks do. Take savings and you earn something because on the other side of it, there's an investment.
I don't recommend anybody does it, but Bitcoin can earn.
Nobody makes Bitcoin loans. It's too volatile. How do you even know what kind of interest rate?
By the way, can I give you one example? Suppose there was Bitcoin as a currency, and suppose mortgages were priced in Bitcoin, and suppose you're right that Bitcoin goes to 1 million. Then everybody's mortgage is totally defaulting, right? The real value of that mortgage go to the roof. That's the consequence of having mortgages in Bitcoin and the price going to
million. Let's talk about
every single homeowner is going to go bankrupt.
Let's talk about the increase in price, and let's also talk about volatility in the same thing, because I think the two of them are pretty much related. The price movements and the is probably related to the adoption of Bitcoin.
But you see what. Again, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for Nouriel's intellect. I've read all of his books and love him, and he's very smart. But what he just said is not fair to Bitcoin, because we're not suggesting, and maybe Eric is, but I'm not suggesting it today, that Bitcoin becomes the currency standard. What I'm suggesting is Bitcoin is on an adoption curve akin to Web 1. And if you go and look at the adoption curve, you got about 5% of the world is adopted into Bitcoin. That puts you at about 1999 for Web 1. If you tell me 25 years from now we get to the adoption of Web 1, then it starts to standardize. And with the standardization, just like Apple back in the day, Amazon back in the day, 80, 90, 100 vol assets, they became volatility assets akin to the S&P. That will happen to Bitcoin over time.
They're not adopting it.
You can't take a volatile asset like that and make it into a mortgage.
You can't say just because somebody wants to bet that Bitcoin goes up, they haven't adopted anything.
See, the reason why we're so early,
you're not early. You're actually pretty late. You got into it late to the game.
Well,
I've made a lot of money on this. I don't really think I got that late to the game.
How do you define early or late in the game?
I'll tell you why. Eric was early.
Okay, but hold on.
Eric was way earlier than me. There's no question about that. But I actually still think it's early.
The world population is.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course you think it's early. So Eric thinks it's early.
Well, you know.
But let me just say this to you. You're on missile lock, okay? You're a 60-year-old white male, and you've lived in a certain world.
What
a certain
does my race
way.
Have to do with it, first of all?
Well, it does. It has a lot to do with it.
So if I was black, I would be into Bitcoin?
No, but if you were 60-year-old and you were black and you were in the financial service community, you'd be equivalent to the same as you are right now. You're a traditionalist, and you're on missile lock in a traditional way of thinking. The world is moving into digitization, and these assets are going to get digitized. And we are going to
tokenize gold.
But you can tokenize the movement. Gold. You can tokenize the movement of food. You can digitize art. I just bought a piece of a Basquiat in a digital
form. Yeah, because you're tokenizing a real thing. Yeah. Bitcoin is tokenizing nothing. I mean, if you want to talk about putting gold on a blockchain and tokenizing gold, that works.
Of digital property that hundreds of millions of people have accepted.
No, they haven't accepted anything. They bought it because they think it's going to go up, and they're planning on selling it. They haven't adopted it.
This is the reason why we're so early, because
why do you think people are in these ETFs? It's just gambling.
Peter, another small point. People say we created digital asset. With the exception of banknotes and currency, everything in our financial system is digital. It's been digital forever. Deposits are digital. Any asset, stocks, bonds, and so on is digital. You don't have a piece of paper like used to be 100 years ago. It says, this is a stock.
So you're moving it over an old-fashioned rail system where you need a third party.
99% of all financial assets or real assets are already digital. And 99.9% of all transactions are digital, because paper money and coins are barely used right now. Everybody uses a credit card or Venmo or PayPal, wire transfer, checks, whatever. Okay, it's a small fraction using coin. So everything has been digital for the last 60 years. The issue is not whether you create digital assets. The question is whether the future of payment system or lending or of asset management or of financial activities or insurance is going to be based on a new technology that you call blockchain or not. Some people say yes, some people say no. So let's not say we created digital assets. Everything is digital in financial system. I would argue that the future of the financial system, because I'm against myself, the traditional financial system, efficiency, corruption, whatever not. I wrote a whole book on crisis economics against the banks. The question is, what you replace it with? my view, the replacement of it is something not based on the blockchain. It's fintech. It's based on big data, Internet of Things that collect the data, AI, machine learning, and IoT, plus 5G, to do what? Payment systems that already are used by billions of people for billions of transactions a day. Venmo, PayPal, Square, Stripe, UPI in India, M-Pesa in Sub-Saharan Africa, Alipay, WeChat Pay around the world. That's the world of payment system alternative to traditional ones. Or peer-to-peer lending using fintech, or insurtech, or robo-advisors, or whatever not. There are thousands of firms that are fintech, have nothing to do with blockchain. They have a business plan, they have income, they have profits, they have revenues, and that's the future of breaking the monopoly of the banking system. So far, after 15 years, people say it's like the early internet. 15 years into internet, we had billions of people using it. You had websites, you had apps, you had HTML, you had everything that revolutionized how we live. You had instant recall of every information under the sun in 5 seconds. So, okay? It was a revolution. What has happened after 15 years of crypto? The biggest innovation is what? Stablecoin is a replication of fiat currencies. Right? Yeah. Replication of fiat currency. They say, stablecoin. Brilliant. Brilliant. That's the great revolution of crypto. Stablecoin.
Eric, you were going to say
they
something.
They have the same debasement risk of fiat currencies. Eric, if you worry about fiat currencies.
Can I ask you a question, Nuru?
Okay. Yes.
You're right when you say that all these financial assets today are digital.
Yes.
Have been. Do you know what makes the digital asset of Bitcoin different from the digital asset of any other thing that you're thinking about? What's the difference?
Supposedly, it's based on the fact that it is a system that is private, trustless, permissionless, and decentralized, and so on. But the reality of it is that if you look and scratch the surface of these things, they're just the opposite, because 99% of all application of corporate DLT or of enterprise blockchain are what? Private, not public, centralized, not decentralized, using trusted validators rather than trustless, and they are permissioned. They're a glorified Google Doc system that is based on same permission that nobody would call blockchain.
Let's keep this discussion.
Every application is not based on what you call a true DLT.
Let's keep this discussion.
Let me talk for a second directly with Nuriel. Okay, Nuriel. I don't want to talk about all these other like blockchain things or private blockchains or all that nonsense. There's a lot of nonsense. I just want to talk about Bitcoin. You said it very well. You said it very succinctly. The difference with Bitcoin is that it is scarce, immutable, decentralized, right? How can you make a statement like that and then in the very next breath not understand that that might have some value?
First of all, you remember Victor Buterin's inconsistently Trinity principle. It says, in anything crypto, you cannot have at the same time something is scalable, secure, and decentralized.
The blockchain... Yeah.
Traditional financial system are secure. Even if somebody steals my bank account or my credit card, in 60 seconds, I block it and might fully hold. In Bitcoin or crypto, if somebody steals your private key, your money is gone forever and ever. So it's not secure. Secondly, it's not scalable. In the traditional financial system, there's massive scalability. Yes, we have a centralized system, but we get 2 out of 3. Take Bitcoin. First of all, it's not secure. Literally, people have to put it in a cold wallet down the ground. It's like taking gold and putting it in the ground, never using it.
Wait, but that's
first of all,
that's secure.
Second point, it's not scalable, and it's not even decentralized. You know, centralization, all the miners, is an oligopoly, many of them in places there is no rule of law, Belarus, China, Russia, and this kind of rogue states. Secondly, you have monopoly of concentration of the wealth. The Gini coefficient of Bitcoin is worse than North Korea. Kim Jong-un and his family own everything. You have a centralization of developers. When something goes wrong, it's not immutable, as you saw with the DAO. They reverse the transactions, right?
I'm talking about Bitcoin.
And then it's centralized because the guys who are part of it are prosecutor, judge, police, and everything. If there's something wrong, they're going to decide how to change it. This idea that it's decentralized is nonsense. Well, it's neither decentralized, nor secure, nor scalable. It's 3 no's out of 3. Well, at least in the traditional one, you get 2 out of 3 right.
Okay,
let's dive in a little more on this point. Okay, you made a claim now, a new claim, that Bitcoin is not decentralized. Decentralization is obviously a spectrum, right? It's not an off and on thing. You say it's not decentralized compared to what?
You have a system of miners, for example, that is totally...
You asked the question, compared to what? When you say Bitcoin is not decentralized, as compared to what?
No, the centralized system will be a system in which there is real competition between, for example, miners, in which the wealth is not concentrated, in which you don't have a bunch of rogue states who are controlling a lot of the supply and the validation. In which the developers are not controlling everything. Those are the criteria for something truly decentralized.
Are you now claiming that rogue states controlled Bitcoin mining?
For a long time they did, and they certainly controlled What
do you base that on?
For a long time, most of the miners were in Russia, in Belarus, China, and other countries like that.
For a long time, most of the miners were in China, and as soon as they banned it, they all disappeared. I think that proves that China doesn't control mining.
Because they banned it.
10%.
They banned it. Okay. That's why.
The decentralization argument, I think Eric's made a very good point here, Nouriel, where he says, look, it is decentralized because when it was concentrated, China banned it, and then it became even more decentralized, with a lot of it actually coming to the U.S. where there's much more regulation, much more oversight, much more scrutiny. We've seen that the U.S., the Justice Department, the DOJ, has been going after unscrupulous players. So I think to that point, I think Eric has made a very good point here that Bitcoin is decentralized and actually is becoming more decentralized. I think you got to agree with that.
There is massive concentration of Bitcoin wealth.
Compared to what?
For example, the Gini coefficient for the United States, where there's a lot of income inequality, is about 0.4, okay? One means one person controls everything. Zero means all equality. So U.S. is that. North Korea, Gini coefficient is 0.84. A study suggested the Gini coefficient of Bitcoin is 0.86. So there's more concentration of wealth in Bitcoin compared to the country where Kim Jong-un and his cronies' family control most of the wealth of the country.
Compared to any other currency or store of value, how does Bitcoin relate? Is it Bitcoin more centralized?
We are speaking about income and wealth.
The
distribution of the assets is controlled by a bunch of whales. The Gini coefficient of Bitcoin is 0.86.
But wait, the distribution of the assets has got nothing to do with the control of the Bitcoin network. You'll agree on that?
No, not control Bitcoin. I'm saying the income inequality, wealth inequality of Bitcoin is worse than North Korea.
Let's go to the wealth.
Nouriel, is that there is wealth concentration in Bitcoin, I will grant that point to you. Well done.
Okay, so there is wealth distribution. Okay.
Yeah. And what happens when some of that wealth tries to get out of Bitcoin?
I mean, it's one of the most liquid markets in the world.
Well, it won't be when they try to sell. I mean, I think...
You said that in 2013, and we're up like 1,000% since then. So the burden is now on you to say why it's going to change.
Well, Bitcoin hasn't gone anywhere in the last 3 years. In fact, in priced in gold, it's about 30% lower than it was 3 years ago. So it's kind of stopped up.
Any stock of any company that has been even a unicorn, let alone $1 trillion company, has gone from zero to $1 billion. So the same price appreciation, because create something, generates goods and services that are good for society. Most of the things in the S&P 500 used to be worth zero at the beginning and now worth a fortune. Thousands of percent of appreciation.
You've taken one point of time and you've used the Bitcoin price in one point of time. If you look at Bitcoin's price in any other point of time, then I think that you could say that Bitcoin has clearly outperformed gold.
Well, Bitcoin...
I'm going to keep this kind of fair.
Yeah,
data from one period of time which suits your thesis, then I've got to call bullshit.
Let me address it. Because to say that Bitcoin has outperformed gold when you go over the last 10 years or something, well, it's outperformed everything. I mean, just like at one point, Beanie Babies outperformed everything. I mean, if you have a bubble in something and the price goes way up, sure, it can outperform everything until the bubble pops. My point is that Bitcoin really stopped going up. If you want to look at when the peak in 2021, when you had this massive publicity push into Bitcoin in all the financial media, you had all these companies spending money. They were advertising like crazy. You know, they had Super Bowl ads. You had the NFTs come out. You had El Salvador. You had Michael Saylor. You had all this stuff.
All the celebrities.
And yeah, the celebrities came on, and all these scams. You know, FTX and Celsius and Terra Luna and all this stuff. And they hyped Bitcoin up to about 69,000 in 2021. And a lot of people rushed in. And here we are, you know, a few years later, we're still around the same price, 60,000. Although recently it got hyped up again with the launch of all these ETFs, which suckered in a lot of retail investors who now, you know, have bought some Bitcoin ETFs because of the big marketing push by these Wall Street firms to get people into it. But over this period of time where you've had all these people come into Bitcoin, the price hasn't even gone up. All the money, all the advertising, all this stuff. Who's been selling? I mean, someone's been selling a bunch of Bitcoin for the price not to have gone up with all this big marketing push. I'm just saying it's over a three-year period of time. It's kind of gone sideways in a volatile way. I think it's topping out. I think we're just starting distribution.
I'm going to give this to Anthony because he speaks very well about volatility. But again, you are taking 1 3-year period
of time. All right, so in 2 years, it'll be 5 years where Bitcoin's gone nowhere. I mean, at some point, you have to recognize that we're distributing the tokens from the early adopters, the whales, to the little minnows who are biting into this and are going to be left holding the bag when the bottom drops out of this. This is literally a blockchain letter. It's like a self-perpetuating Ponzi pyramid. You know, it's all about people buying it because they think the price is going to go up. And the only reason people will buy it is because they think somebody else. It's all a greater fool theory. Peter, and you have more people betting on it. And it doesn't even matter whether it's decentralized. It's all based on faith and confidence. People have to believe that Bitcoin is going to have value.
Before Eric talks, and Eric, I promise you I'm going to give you a chance to respond. Okay. I do want to tell our audience that if Peter is making a convincing argument for you to invest in physical gold or physical silver, and there are a lot of other people that are actually saying the same thing, then we do have a sponsor. Our sponsor is Preserved Gold. If you want to invest in physical gold or physical silver, what I suggest you do is that you text zero, that's ZERO, to 50505, and they will send you an investment guide. And you can look at that investment guide. They can help you get gold or silver delivered to your doorstep, to your 401k, to your IRA, to your retirement plan, to anything that you want. They're a triple B rated company. They've got great reviews. They'll give you guys $10,000, a special promotion for us here today, $10,000 if you qualify. Also, if you just text zero to 50505, you will get $500 in an account balance. So don't delay. Don't wait for the economy to collapse. Don't wait for governments to seize your goods. Listen to what Peter's saying, if he's convincing you, and text zero, that's ZERO, to 50505. Again, last time, zero to 50505. Eric, I'm now coming back to you, and I want you to address Peter's points around volatility and distribution of Bitcoin from whales, early adopters, to what he calls unsuspecting retail.
I call them retail suckers.
Suckers is a good word.
Okay. I mean, you said that in 2013, and anyone who didn't listen to you and listened to me like made so much money that like they don't need to work ever again. Again, empiricism.
Yes, I concede the bubble is a lot bigger than it was.
But you said
then.
It was a bubble in 2013.
It was.
Peter.
It was a smaller bubble. Now it's a bigger bubble.
Have some humility of being so abjectly wrong.
It's got nothing to do with humility,
Peter. With respect, he let you speak. Let him speak.
Right. We don't need to talk too much about price because price is an objective, measurable scoreboard, and the scoreboard says that you are losing badly.
No, it doesn't. Not over the last few years. Okay. Yes, if you go back to your time frame, sure, from when we first spoke about it.
But you brought it down to a time frame of 3 years. He's brought it down to the macro time frame.
You'll always be able to go back to when Bitcoin was a penny and say how well it's done. Even if Bitcoin falls to $100, you can still say, well, look how much it's up from a penny. I mean,
could there be an argument that since Bitcoin is a technology, this is the natural adoption curve of the technology?
And it's not a technology. Well, maybe blockchain is a technology. Bitcoin is nothing. It's just a string of numbers.
Precisely. 90% of people who bought Bitcoin, they did not buy it when it was 100 or 1,000 or even 10,000. 99% of them bought it when it was well above prices.
So first of
that's
all,
absurd. That's
first
of all,
we're probably above.
That's true. That's
because when
we went to 20,000, I remember that year, everybody, even my cleaning lady, was asking me, should I buy Bitcoin?
and then it collapsed from 20 to 3. Then it went up again to 69, boom again, everybody bought it, and then went down to 16. And then again went from 16 now to 70. Now it's fallen already 25%. And every wave, if you look at correlation between the price of Bitcoin and number of users, it's like a 99% correlation.
As a moderator here, I've got to call bullshit when there's bullshit on the table. And when you say that 99% of people bought the asset at a certain price, the data on the Bitcoin chain actually says otherwise.
What does the data say? No.
The data says that the realized price of Bitcoin today amongst all holders is somewhere around 58,000 or 52,000.
Yeah, that's a pretty high price. Okay. That means most people barely have a profit.
Is the price today?
It's about 62,000.
No, it's 53.
It's about 62. It went up.
But listen, you guys
yesterday was 53.
The low was 53.
In the arguments that you guys are making, and I want to be respectful to you guys, and I appreciate you being respectful of us, but you're leaving out like chunks of information that you got to put into the story.
What?
Well, Bitcoin is volatile. You had an approval process for the Bitcoin futures ETF. It was approved November 10th, 2021. By any administrative standard in the United States, the Bitcoin Cash or the Bitcoin Spot ETF would have approved shortly thereafter because of what it says in administrative law. You can't be arbitrary and capricious. We have regulators, czarist regulators, that have taken over the process. They don't focus on what's right or wrong anymore or what is appropriate based on the law. They decide that they're going to do things against the law, and they've lost several court cases. So the three-year interregnum period that you're talking about, the people in the industry had to go to court with czarist regulators to defeat them.
Yeah, so you're saying the problem with Bitcoin is we didn't have ETFs where people can centralize them with a third-party custodian.
No, I'm saying something different.
What is that?
The problem with Bitcoin is it's such a new asset and that it's still scaling. It's only got 5% adoption, that the regulators, like they tried to stop Uber, and Uber wasn't stopped, but every regulator wanted to, they tried to stop Bitcoin.
Yeah,
and
you know, Bitcoin I get a kick, Anthony.
Bitcoin is unstoppable.
I get a big kick out when I hear all these people say, yeah, the ETFs are great because Bitcoin is so hard to buy. It's so complicated. People can't figure
it out.
People can't store themselves. Oh, so now
people
they can buy
the ETFs.
People who are buying it in an ETF can't do anything with that Bitcoin. It's pure gambling. You're taking something that you can
buy.
The reason why the delay was in regulation, because during those years, as you remember, a whole bunch of crooks and institution exchanges from Celsius to FTX to Terra to whatever not, first of all, they collapsed. And as you know, in the crypto world, maybe less now, but there was massive amount of manipulation, literally wash trading, spoofing, fake trades, whole bunch of things that maybe had changed. And regulators wanted to reach the point in which they were comfortable enough that there was no manipulation of the price of Bitcoin. And we know based on academic studies that a lot of this stuff for a long time was highly manipulated. But so it was not based on whim or not wanting to do the ETF. The rules why we want to protect especially small investors. And if something's ETF is available to everybody, and therefore, we have to go carefully.
Well, those small investors are going to get wiped out of those ETFs.
Okay,
Eric. They're the bag holders. They came in at the end.
They've always been the bag holders.
All right. Okay, Eric, I know you've been wanting to say something, so I'm going to give you the floor.
Yeah. I feel like you guys are like in Plato's cave, like arguing about the shadows on the wall, and I'm sitting out here and just using a different financial system that works as it was advertised like 15 years ago. And I respect both of you, and I wish I could just convey that like it just works. Like if you just use it, it just works. And it defeats immediately the argument that it has no utility. And its track record of performance and growth over time, where it's gone through multiple bubbles and recovered and gone on to a higher one and recovered and gone on to a higher one, you can't dismiss it as a beanie baby. You can't dismiss it as tulips. There is no bubble or Ponzi scheme in history that ever had a second peak that went higher than the first one. You need new arguments.
So you're saying because it's every time it is collapsed in the past, it's made a new high, that it's guaranteed to do that
again? I never said guaranteed to do anything.
All right. So then at some point, it could collapse for good.
It may not.
This is financial advice. Obviously, buy some Bitcoin and sell your dollars. Dollars are just being debased constantly. This is financial advice.
Yeah, but it's not going to go on in perpetuity. The reason it works for you is because people continue to gamble on it. You got in a long time ago when the price was lower, and the prices got up. And there are people who are willing to pay this higher price. And so you are able to sell the Bitcoin you bought a long time ago. And so that works out great for you. But the people who are buying it now, it's not going to work out so great for them. Because when they want to sell, the price is going to be a lot lower.
Peter, with respect, I have to try and remain neutral here. But I bought Bitcoin much later than Eric. And at a time where you said that I was very late. And I ended up making a lot of money by buying it very late. I maybe didn't make as much.
Well, have you sold?
Yeah, of course I've sold some.
Okay, so you're out of it now.
No. I've sold some.
All right. Well, have you sold enough to take your investment out?
No.
So you still might end up losing.
So at what point, when did early become late? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I think all the people that have bought over the last few years are late to the party.
When you say few, 1 year, 2 years,
okay, if you bought Bitcoin at 20,000 or higher, you bought late. Right. If you bought,
if I bought Bitcoin at 20,000, I've made a 3x return on my money.
What do you mean? You could have bought a lot of things and made a 3x. Look, there's a lot of stocks that have gone up 3x.
Let's talk specifically about gold. Yeah. At the time when Bitcoin was trading at $20,000, what was the gold price?
I don't remember exactly. Maybe it was 1,500 or 1,400 or 1,700. But you can't compare Bitcoin to gold. Gold is a conservative store of value. You have to compare Bitcoin to maybe one of the Mag 7 stocks that you could have bought. You know, you could have bought Nvidia, made a lot and made more money than you made in Bitcoin. I mean, why do you want to compare it to gold? It's nothing like gold. It doesn't have any of the properties.
Gold a decade or so ago was worth around 1,200. Now it's worth something like 2,400. Has not gone up and down like this. Has been stable. Have been waves, but it's giving you a return because we live in a world in which I worry also about inflation, the debasement of fiat currency. But you know what? Take Bitcoin. People said it's a hedge against inflation. It's an uncorrelated or negatively correlated asset to risky assets. When the inflation was going from 2% to almost 10, 21, 22, you remember what happened? Bitcoin crashed while gold was going higher. And every time the stock market goes up, Bitcoin goes higher, but when every time it falls, it falls much more than that. So, first of all, it's not a hedge against inflation because inflation now is falling and Bitcoin has gone up in price. Right. When inflation was going up,
Inflation's not falling.
Listen, one year ago was 9, now it's 3. Inflation is 3 now. A year ago was 9%.
Yeah, that's the rate of growth.
That's the rate of growth.
It's still growing.
Bitcoin went up 3x still happening. Since January.
There is always some inflation because the target of central bank is 2% inflation.
It's not an inflation hedge.
So saying there's always inflation.
It's not an inflation hedge. It's not.
You have more purchasing power related to Bitcoin today than you did in 2020 relative to the U.S.
Just
dollar.
Because
dollar dropped 25%.
The price
Bitcoin
can go
up
without
times.
It being an inflation hedge. Peter, the price could collapse over the next year.
When inflation was going higher,
when inflation
was going higher, Bitcoin was collapsing. Now the inflation is falling, Bitcoin is going up. So it's not a hedge against inflation.
Okay, but the thing
and it's not uncorrelated or
not
uncorrelated.
That's not why it's not a hedge.
The interesting thing that Eric's not saying, because Eric has said, well, empirically, I've obviously won this thing because of the returns. You don't agree with that. But the thing that none of us are saying is that the way the system is set up right now, that number that Noriel's talking about, the Kim L. Jung number, is going to get way worse in the United States because as you debase the dollar, you're crushing the lower and middle class people, and the people that have assets are going to have more dollar-based nominal assets, and you're separating the people. I believe that what Eric and I are saying is if you hold Bitcoin over that period of time, as people lose confidence in the asset that you're debasing, this asset will be there
for them.
How
do you know? What if people lose confidence in Bitcoin? What if people stop believing in it? What if the price collapses?
People lose confidence in gold. They can lose confidence in the United States.
Because gold is an actual metal that's been around for 5,000 years and is used in all sorts of things. Gold is not about confidence. Gold has value because of the properties it has as a metal. It's not based on confidence. Bitcoin is all based on confidence. People have to decide.
Noriel,
they think
is gold
be worth
at the inflation-adjusted price that it was in 1980 when it went to $800 an ounce? Is it if you inflation adjusted gold, it's $2,400 right now. It was $800 an ounce in 1980.
Yeah. So well, in 1970 it was 35. Well, at that time, it was $35 in 1970.
Inflation was double digit, but if you're looking at long period of time throughout the centuries, I would say that gold, and I have to look at the data, probably increases as much as the price level. So in real term, probably gold has been always, like most commodities, right? Production of commodities as some inputs of labor and capital go up with the price level.
But you guys so are just gold saying has to go, Bitcoin is a gambling token, and so it's gone from one penny to $61,000 because it's a gambling token. And so when you both have read about Robert Metcalfe's law, and the network effect of something you're saying, so the network itself is worth zero. The transactionable capabilities of it, the fact that Eric can send $1 million to somebody in 5 minutes, that's a completely worthless part of it. And the only value in Bitcoin is that some greater fool will pay more for it today than what it's currently priced, at least the people that own it. But that's the only reason why they're buying it. Yep. And so, therefore, it's just a gambling token.
The reason that most people are buying it is they think they're going to get rich. That's the reason most people are buying it. You're too smart for that.
You know, your IQ is higher than that. Today we have done a debate, gold versus Bitcoin.
But as you know, in the last decade, since cryptocurrency were launched, there were about 20,000 ICOs. 80% of them were really a scam to begin with. People took the money.
But let's
they went to my
Wait, that's relevant.
Because once you have something where...
It's not relevant.
No, wait. 80% of them were a scam. 17% of them have lost all their value. 3% are surviving. About 600. With exception of the top 10, most of them have lost 80% or more since their peak.
So you have to ask yourself, this asset class,
where you say it's going to change the world, because it's all tokenization, it's all cryptocurrency and so on, has been a miserable scam or criminal activity or a failure.
Okay, I want to make 2 points.
And then you say Bitcoin.
Well, I want to make two points.
Bitcoin is worth, what's worth? $1 trillion. Big deal. The value of all real and financial assets in the world are about 200 trillion.
Okay, so Nuril,
so 0.5% of all real and financial assets in the world.
I want to make 2 points.
Who cares? Who fucking cares?
And it's all about price. Okay, I want to make two points.
And someday, some months is worth 500 million, some months is 200, or some months becomes a trillion.
I want to make 0.5% of world wealth. Nuril, I want to make 2 points here. Number one, I think the discussion today is around Bitcoin and not around other crypto assets. And I think let's keep it around Bitcoin and not around other crypto assets.
But you can't ignore the other crypto assets. People say crypto is going to change the world. To your other point,
in any kind of technological venture capital market, 90% of all the ventures fail, and the 10% that actually succeed make up for those returns. So to point at the ones that have failed and to say that because of that, Bitcoin is a scam, I think that's a stretch.
But wait a moment.
That's not in the spirit of today's discussion.
80% of the ICOs were a scam to begin with. In the internet, there were 20 pet.coms. 18 out of 20 failed because they had a good business
plan.
But the idea of selling online pet food and other things for your dog and cat was a reasonable idea of providing goods and services.
It was not a scam to begin with.
Those were the bad plan, failed, and only a couple of them survived. But they were not a scam to begin with. That's a big difference.
Nuril, please, Eric.
Most ventures fail, but they're not the scam. That's capitalism.
We're supposed to be talking about Bitcoin, but we can talk about other assets too. What's your claim that many of these have been scams? I'll grant it. Not many.
Well, 80% of them were
but
scams.
But you're saying Bitcoin
people
is a scam.
People take the money, ICO, they don't okay, do it through IPO, and they go to Miami, and they buy boats, and they buy Lambos, and they go to Puerto Rico, and they buy yachts, and so on, and the money disappears. Okay?
But when you talk about Bitcoin, though, as an example of a success,
sleazy.
You had all these coins that failed, and you say Bitcoin's a success, all it succeeded in doing is going up in price. And so people who bought it on paper who have a profit. But most of these holders, let me finish my point. Most of the holders who are holding on to Bitcoin, you got people that have a bunch of money in Bitcoin, but they still live with their parents, you know, because they don't want to spend their Bitcoin because they think it's going to just keep going up.
But eventually
the people who have Bitcoin, they're going to want to buy things. And in order to buy things, they have to sell their Bitcoin. Because all the people that have the merchandise that they want aren't accepting Bitcoin. They need to convert it to real money. The people who bought these Bitcoin ETFs, they're going to want to take a profit They're not going to die with these Bitcoin. They bought it as a trade. They're going to want to get out. And so when you have people trying to buy stuff and actually realize their gains, they're going to evaporate because there's not going to be enough new buyers to let them get out.
This is 2013 Peter Schiff talking, and I would love to hear from 2024 Peter Schiff.
2013 Peter Schiff was still right that the price is going to ultimately collapse. I was commenting on the NASDAQ tech bubble, you know, early on, the housing bubble early on. And as I was talking about it, housing prices were going up. Tech prices were going up. Every bubble I've ever identified, I've identified it early. But that doesn't mean I was wrong. Yes, could I have profited off of other people's, you know, foolishness and greed? Had I bought a bunch of Bitcoin and sold it? Sure, I could have done that. But I didn't do it.
Why didn't you do it?
Well, you don't know. It's very easy to buy Bitcoin if you actually believe in it. But if you know it's not going to work, buying it to just gamble on other people making a mistake of buying it, it's a more difficult thing to do.
You have an asset class where 97% of these ICOs have gone to a value of zero. Okay?
But you said fundamental
value was zero.
I want to address that point.
Zero. Actually, fundamental value is not zero. It's negative given the toxic externalities of using energy at a high cost.
Okay, well,
using the right carbon tax, the value will be negative, not zero.
Using energy is a good thing, not a bad thing.
No, but that's a difference of energy.
No, you're wasting
97%
energy.
97% of them is zero.
How is it good to waste energy mining nothing? Not even mining. You're solving a problem.
Peter, please.
It's a waste of energy.
Nuriel, please, Peter, please. Yeah. Eric, you wanted to respond.
Let's address this like all the coins were scams argument.
Not all, 97%.
Okay, use whatever number you want. I'll grant it.
Well, that's the fact.
I'll grant it.
97%.
I think It's not a fact.
Just let me talk. Here's another fact. One single ICO, Ethereum, is worth more today for all the asset holders that have it than all the money lost in all the scam coins. A single success story of an ICO is returning vastly more by one or two orders of magnitude than anything that was lost in everything else.
For now, I mean, the price could still collapse.
But that's an unfalsifiable claim, Peter. You can always state that. You can't just keep saying it and think that people will keep giving you credibility. It's been 11 years since you first said that.
In the scheme of things, that's not that long.
When will be? Give us a falsifiable date. When will Peter Schiff be wrong?
How am I supposed to know that? I mean, I think I'm already right. The question is, when will the market validate? No, it's not going to take 100 years. We're in the process of it happening right now.
Ethereum has had cycles where from peak to trough, it's fallen about 80 to 90% at least four or five times in the last 15 years. And unless you get the timing right.
Sounds like Amazon.
But I can show you a chart where the correlation between the price of Bitcoin or Ethereum and the number of users is almost 100%. That means when the price goes higher, people come in because there is all the buzz about it, and they peak when the price peaks, and then they collapse the use and so on. That means that most people arrive too late, the retail suckers buy the peak, then they panic, and they sell at the bottom, and on average they lose money.
This has happened over and over again. Any speculative market brings in the mass of fools toward the end. This is not unique to cryptocurrency.
Right, and that is a phenomenon. Fools have been buying Bitcoin for several years now.
Well, hold on. You have bubbles in illegitimate assets and you have bubbles in legitimate assets, right? The railroad industry went through a massive bubble. The tech stocks went through a massive bubble. And in both of those cases, just like with crypto, you had a bunch of people getting involved right at the end and losing their shirts. That is not a demonstration that the utility of the actual asset isn't there. That's just a phenomenon of speculative cycles.
In every technological revolution, there is a bubble. Railroads, steam engine, electricity, the internet, you name it. But after the bubble went bust, a new technology changed the world completely, emerged. There was a bubble, railroads remained, electricity remained, the internet remained, okay? That's a difference.
Bitcoin's
still
here.
15 years into this thing, the most great thing about it is stable coins that are variant of fiat currency.
That's an assertion you're making.
Which are the users? There is a huge amount of trade. You buy one against the other one. There is no, the fact again, you're saying I can sell it in 5 seconds around the world. I can do that as well if I didn't have MLK OSC.
I think
it's not a technological constraint.
It's absolutely nuts to observe a technological development that allows someone, any individual, from their cell phone to send any amount of money anywhere on Earth in 5 minutes.
You're not sending the money, you're sending the Bitcoin.
My parents and my sister live in Israel. I send them money every month. What do I do it? I do it with Venmo. How long does it take me to transfer money from here to Israel? literally takes 5 seconds, not 5 minutes, 5 seconds. Cool. I send it, there is an email that comes, says the money was transferred to their account. 5 seconds. Eric, I can do it with Venmo, I can do it with PayPal, I can do it with Square, all over the world.
Yeah.
Of course, if I want to send $1 billion, a bank is going to say, wait a moment, where are you sending it, who is sending it, and I have to check it. Fair enough.
Okay.
But the idea that it's going to take forever, come on, all these fintech solutions are used by billions of people for billions of transactions every freaking day. Payments of goods and services. You buy, you go in China, there's no more currencies. Alipay, WeChat Pay. Who's using cash anymore? I use Venmo, I use PayPal, I use whatever. Zelle, every day, in and out. That's payment system. It's the future payment system. It's not going to be anything crypto. Maybe it's a store of value. Maybe it is a store of value. But it's not going to be a currency. It's not going to be a means of payment.
Mario.
As I said, in El Salvador, where you force people to accept it, nobody's using it to buy goods and services. That's a fact.
What if your family was in Russia? How would you send them money right now? Tell me that.
There are...
Going to use Venmo? Going to use PayPal?
No, there are...
Going to use the banking
there
system?
There are some autocratic and dictatorial systems in which people are oppressed. In those dictatorial, oppressive systems, you may transfer some money using your crypto somewhere else. That's true.
Wait a moment.
If they want to seize your companies, your business empire, your home, if they want to kill you and put you in prison, they can do it, okay? So the fact that you have that freedom of doing something else is really second or third order of living in a dictatorship.
But 5.7 billion people live in dictatorships.
You'll accept that there is a probability that a lot of the viewers here have got relatives in Russia and would like to send money to relatives in Russia. And you've just said that maybe cryptocurrency is a solution for them.
Well, we know that Binance was used by the Revolutionary Guards in Iran to money launder $15 billion of money. That's a fact.
Okay.
Bad actors can use it more than actually good actors.
Okay, Eric. Muriel. So I think you've acknowledged that there could be, hypothetically, a situation in which someone in a bad regime would find it useful to be able to receive money through Bitcoin. Right,
but what about all the other cryptos?
Hold on, sure, some of them are valuable too. But hold on,
there's
hold
an
on,
unlimited
Peter.
Number that can
Peter,
be created.
Hold on. If you admit even one case of utility for Bitcoin, you can't go around continuing to say that it is nothing. You can argue about the price, you can say it's overpriced or underpriced or whatever, but you can't keep using the argument that it has no utility because you just acknowledge that it might. Sometimes.
I'll tell you why not. As long as that, how to say, Bitcoin wallet in Moscow is on an exchange, unless that's not the case, you can transfer the money and that dictator the next day can essentially seize all that money from you. The same way you can expropriate through taxation or expropriation your real assets, your financial assets, your money, your deposits. If they want to do it, as long as it's on a wallet, they know who you are, they know what money is there, they can take it from you.
They will
so
know.
Unless it's 100% anonymous and decentralized and blah, blah, blah. And guess what? No government in the world, not only autocrats, but also Democrats, are allowing a system in which everything is 100% anonymous. That's not going to be acceptable. So unfortunately, you can have all the wealth you want into crypto. If a dictator wants to screw you, they'll screw you. Guaranteed. Actually, it's easier. Law enforcement authorities, you well know, prefer actually to find terrorists, human traffickers, when they do transaction using blockchain. Because, you know every transaction, where it is, instead of having this domino of financial center offshore and so on. So they can track you much better. The good guys,
the bad guys
can track you even better.
The Great Firewall
of China means that they know everything about you. They know what you do in private, in school, in the streets, on the train,
they're not
at
gods,
home, in your bedroom.
They know everything about you.
So that's the world of dictators, I'm sorry to say.
Let Eric
make
his point. Go ahead, Peter.
I'm addressing his point. Yeah, you can transfer Bitcoin. Right? It's easier to transfer it, but it all depends on the value of what you're transferring. Is there going to be a market for it in the future? Is there going to be a price for it? The main reason there's a price for Bitcoin now is because people want to speculate on a future price appreciation. But if people lose confidence in that, if they don't think Bitcoin is, you know, going to go to the moon, if they think it's topped out, the market's going to collapse. And so, yeah, you can transfer it, but what is it going to be worth when the guy gets it? And then what are they going to be able to sell it for? You know,
these are all scary questions that market participants have to deal with when they're actually using real assets.
But you're,
things can be volatile, and like I'm not scared of prices.
You're
and people that can't get paid other ways
this
are probably
is why
okay
your arguments
with a 5% decline.
But again, and again, you know, who's to say that I can't use a different crypto than and you know, even though there's 20,000 other cryptos, whatever, that exist today, and some of them maybe are better than Bitcoin, some are not, but somebody could come up with a new and better Bitcoin tomorrow that everybody said, hey, this is what we use. Forget about that old one. Isn't this one is newer, it's better,
it
it's faster.
Isn't it great to have like actual innovation in markets and creativity and finance?
But then what happens to the value of all your Bitcoin when nobody wants it anymore because there's something better?
It could change.
There has been a revolution in payment system. All these fintech solution payment system did not exist in 2008 when Bitcoin was started. 15 years later, as I said, billions of people every day do billions of transactions using this fintech system. They have nothing to do with blockchain.
But not in Russia.
It's a fact.
Not in Russia. Not in Russia. Not in China.
Not in China, they use Alipay with ChatPay, actually. Yeah, you go to China, nobody's using cash.
How are you going
to
send your Chinese
All over Africa, okay, where financial system, you don't have bank branches, everybody's using M-Pesa, okay? So there's been a revolution that has allowed even the poor farmer in Africa to do payment system instantaneously, to microcredit and other things. It's changed the lives of people. Bitcoin in Africa has not made any difference to anybody.
Cool. I would love to see you send M-Pesa from your penthouse in New York to someone in Africa.
It's not possible.
I can do Venmo. The most important thing, not me to send M-Pesa, but within sub-Saharan Africa, the payment system has become essentially based on M-Pesa. And that's a revolution for them.
Okay. Look, I'm not saying there shouldn't be other systems.
And if there is a dictator in Nigeria, if you transfer your Bitcoin to a wallet that is on exchange in Nigeria, they can go and seize it.
You're making arguments against third-party custodians. Huh? You're making arguments against third-party custodians. Of course, if you leave your Bitcoin with a third-party custodian, it's no different than leaving your money with a bank.
That's anyone what who actually doing with the ETFs,
you know, in, that's not, in, wait, 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 everywhere around the world, the regulation of crypto, whatever you want to call them, is based on having wallets that are maintained by exchanges.
Can I ask these guys a question?
And they have to know exactly what you have, so that if there is a tax liability, they can go to the exchange and say,
is there anything that would change your mind, Nouriel?
What?
Is there anything, like, because you're a very smart guy, and we know when smart people, facts change, smart people change their mind. Is there anything? You guys have both spoken in absolutes. It's a gambling token.
What is happening in
we think
space.
It's not a gambling token.
No.
What would change your mind? Okay. What fact would have to happen
My view of the financial system, payment, let's not talk about asset management or capital market activity or insurance or lending. Payment systems in the future are going to be based, first of all, on having central bank digital currencies. They're not going to dominate everything. There'll be limit to how much you can have it in. Things. They're not going to have problems of privacy because in every democracy, they already found technological solution to make sure that the same way in which today, if a law enforcement authority, tax authority wants to do an audit on you, they know everything about you because they can go to the bank and find out everything you have. Same thing is going to happen when there is a CBDC. The government doesn't know what's there, but if there's a tax audit, they can find out. Okay, so there's not going to be any risk of the government taking over, knowing everything you're doing. That's bullshit. So you're going to have this system with CBDCs, first of all. Then you're going to have tokenized deposits because the banks don't want to be disintermediated. Tokenization of deposits probably is a good idea. People believe in stable coins. The problem with stable coins is they are literally going back to free banking. And whenever you have free banking, like in the 19th century, you can have things that are bubbled, they collapse, and then having lots of different monies doesn't make sense. The only way to avoid it, regulation of stable coin is going to be, they have to be like a narrow bank. So if you have a stable coin, everything has to be 100% in short-term treasury that are safe. And then there will be other things that are part of the financial system, like the fintech and payment system. And then there'll be these crypto things. They're going to be whatever you want to call them. There'll be a small piece of this thing. They're not going to be currencies. They're nothing to do with payment system. For international transactions, there'll be stuff that occurs instantaneously once we have everybody's ID regulated. Then you can transfer money knowing who is a criminal, who is not. And that's going to happen because technology can allow you to do this in 5 seconds like we do with Venmo. So that's going to be the payment system of the world, in which crypto is just a little piece of something,
but doesn't matter. That's what's going to be the revolution in financial services. In payments, and we can talk about other things if you want to.
Anthony, what would change your mind, though? You always ask me what would change my mind and get me to accept crypto. What would get you to change your mind and realize that you're mistaken? And
So what would change your mind?
Nothing, right? As I said, I can't think of something that would make me believe in it. You can ask me what would change my mind about Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to suddenly believe that nothing is something. I just can't conceive of how I'm going to change my mind.
So I'll tell you what would make me change my mind. Because there's value in the network. And you don't believe that there's value in the network.
There may be some value in the network. I don't know what it is.
Eric just explained brilliantly why there is value in the network. And so if you told me the entire network collapsed and we went from 350 million wallets to 10 wallets, then I would tell you, okay, I got this wrong.
The
value of the network is to tokenize deposits that are something, real financial assets. Tokenization of financial and real assets of various sorts. They can be all tokenized. And we'll have a world in which things can be done as a more liquid, they can be transferred, because there is tokenization of things that are real and financial assets, not of vaporware. If you tokenize vaporware, it means vaporware. If you tokenize gold,
that they're willing to trade with each other.
So I think on that note,
and I believe that there is. You guys believe that there isn't. He obviously believes that there is. And in 10 years, I believe there'll be 2 billion people. Up from 300 million people that are on that network.
No, it's not. Guessing. No, of course
it is. It's based on the adoption curve.
You can't assume that that's going to continue.
When I bought my first Bitcoin, it was at 80 million. Now it's at 350 million.
They're not adopting it. They're just trading it. They're not using it for anything. They're gambling with it. And you don't know that they're going to keep doing that in 10 years.
Just explain how they're using it. Eric just explained how
they're
using it.
They're not 5 billion people who have Apple or Meta or Google, even if it's been amazing. You have to ask yourself, why 5 billion people are going to use Bitcoin?
So hold on.
What are they using? Transferring money across the border without any restriction. We've already technology allows to do this. So they only use, you talked about, was one to avoid taxes, and the other one that you can do instantaneous things. The former one, financial system are going to do instant stuff in the next 10
respect,
years. And the second one, every government is going to regulate what they want to regulate, period.
So Peter said you wouldn't change your mind for anything, because you used the example of Santa Claus. Nuriel, you gave us a good thing. Mooch, you said if the network usage goes down and people unadopt Bitcoin, you would change your mind.
I'd have to.
Eric, is there anything that would change your mind? You've been a Bitcoin evangelist since the beginning.
That's a good one. If the value of the networks, as measured by the daily volumes and or the market cap of the assets,
collapsed
by 99% and remained there for a period of time,
Of course, by then it's too late, you're open.
Correct.
You'll change your mind when you're broke.
Peter, okay. I have never said that Bitcoin is some guarantee of anything. It is a risky, speculative asset, and I said that in 2011, and I'll say it in 2024. It's a risky, speculative asset, and the speculation that you're making is that people, over time, at the margins, might choose to leave government currencies, which is just a bunch of socialist nonsense, which is being debased and destroyed in perpetuity, and they might choose something that was actually derived from the free market.
So why not choose gold?
One second.
They might choose
both. They might choose gold. I love gold. Bitcoin's at $1.4 trillion on its way to 16.
You don't know where gold may be 32. It could be on 1.4 on its way.
You don't know where gold is going.
And what about tokenized gold?
You don't know where gold is going.
Those tokens operate on blockchain networks that are powered by the cryptocurrencies below them. You can't have stable.
But they don't need Bitcoin.
Yes, they do. You can't have stable coins without Ethereum. You can't have stable coins without Ethereum.
Even if you were Bitcoin.
Even if you were right on the store of value, first of all, there are tons of other good store of values, real financial assets in the world.
Such as?
Real estate, stocks of good companies, everything else under the sun is a good store of value, okay? Gold and others, commodities. There are lots of good store of values, first of all.
Agreed.
Let's assume they are. Even if you were right, is one of many different store of values, not necessarily the best in the world, in which every asset, by the way, is going to be either tokenized or digital. You can buy gold GDL, ETF. You can do lots of things that transfer gold instantaneously, okay? Secondly, even in that world, especially because it's a store of value that rises, say,
10% like equities per year, it cannot rise by 100% forever. That doesn't make any sense. Suppose it rises by 10% like equities. Best scenario is going to be something that remains a store of value, because something that is rising by 10% in value every year cannot be a means of payment. Okay, so even in the best scenario, is at best one of the many store of values in the world, and it's not going to be a means of payment.
Okay, so Nuriel, on that note, we are starting to run out of time. Gentlemen, I am going to give you guys 1 minute each to make a closing statement. Nuriel, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to work our way around the table. 1 minute each, just to sum up your stance at the end of tonight.
Well, as I said, Bitcoin is not a currency, based on the definition of what a currency is. It's not even an asset based on other things. I think in a world in which people worry about the debasement of fiat currency, people are looking at alternatives that may be a good store of value. The experience of Bitcoin is that it's not a hedge against inflation or debasement. I think there is an element that is self-fulfilling, speculative about it. And I'm against the traditional financial system. I believe the future of the financial system is fintech, has nothing to do with blockchain. So there'll be a revolution because there is lots of scam, there's lots of corruption, lots of stuff that are not good in our financial system. But the revolution in financial system is not going to be crypto or blockchain. It's going to be stuff decentralized based on AI, machine learning, IoT, big data, and it's happening right now.
Thank you very much. Nuriel, thank you very much. Peter, 1 minute. Please, if you could keep it down to 1 minute.
Yeah.
Any concluding thoughts?
Well, I don't believe the Bitcoin as digital gold. I just think it's the latest iteration of fool's gold. It's digital fool's gold. If you really want to get out of fiat currency, if you're worried about inflation and monetary debasement, and you want to have a store of value, and you want to have, you know, rather other than just making more traditional investments like buying stocks or buying real estate, then buy actual gold. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. Gold still works, and I do think that the properties of gold will be improved through the internet or blockchain or other technologies that will make gold even more liquid, even more divisible, even more portable and spendable in the future than it has been in the past. So it's worked really well in the past. It'll work better in the future. So you don't have to buy Bitcoin or one of these Bitcoin ETFs. You can actually buy physical gold. You can buy physical silver. And if you don't know, I'm in that business too, right? I've got Shift Gold, so people can go and they want to buy real gold. I can help them get it.
Are you competing with our sponsor, Preserve Gold?
I guess.
Because they are triple B rated, and they do deliver to your house, your IRA, your 401k.
Yeah, we do all that too.
There's also financial gold as well.
Can we text zero to 5-0?
I'm not going to give anybody $10,000 worth of free gold, so I can't do that.
Our sponsor will though, so remember to text zero to 50505. Mooch, you have a minute.
Well, I'm going to take 10 seconds. I'm going to cede my time to Eric.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
This is when the ex-presidential spokesman has nothing to say.
No, I know how to be brief. I'm going to ask people to read Professor Ferguson's book, The Ascent of Money. Check off the properties that is money. Check off the properties that we see as stores of value. And then read the Bitcoin white paper after that. And I will submit to you that people will buy Bitcoin and the network
Can I take back your time and say, look, just for tonight, a lot of people don't know what's in those books, and we want some of the wisdom that actually comes.
It's very simple. There's a safety issue, there's a trust issue, there's a verification issue, there's an immutability issue. Bitcoin has all of those things, which is the reason why it started as an idea 15 years ago, and over 300 plus million people are using it.
Using it or gambling?
Hold on, Peter. Eric, you have two. We have 1.5 minutes because
90 seconds
because Mooch gave you. He ceded 30 seconds of his time to you.
Okay,
and we want to hear it. So,
okay. First of all, a world in which gold was the money again would be a superior world to the status quo. I'll grant that. My primary concern is that the world has money that is derived out of market processes rather than out of coercive centralization of the state. The latter is extremely an un-American and dangerous plague that has existed now since at least 1971 when the dollar became a fiat currency. Anything that moves the world away from centralized control of money to market-based control of money is something that I would be in favor of. Peter, I will praise you. If you can get the world to accept gold again as a form of normal money, that would be great. There are some other of us who don't wish to wait around for that. And we actually think a decentralized form of money that you can send in a digital world has value. And back in 2011, 2012, 2013, when we had our first debate, I understand that like the burden of proof was on us. We had to argue that it was a currency or that it was a money. We had to make those statements because no reason for anyone to believe us back then. But it's 2024, and this is a $1.2 trillion asset, one of the most liquid assets in the world, one of the top 10 assets in the entire world by market cap. I don't need to keep making the case that Bitcoin is something. The world believes it's something. You can see why if you ever go try to send a transaction internationally with a bank and you do it with Bitcoin on your phone. Anyone who's done those two things will see the value immediately. And I don't have to like defend it much, right? It's just growing and it's an option. There's no Bitcoiner that would force either of you to ever use it. And if you want to stay in the traditional financial system, go down with the Titanic, go for it. Many of us are choosing an alternative.
I'm on the Voorhees life raft, just so you know.
Well, I'm not going down with the ship
Peter, have you changed your mind after that beautiful closing statement?
There's no question.
If Jesus
that the world,
dropped in or Moses
not the whole
with
world,
the tablets, he
but
wouldn't
there
change
is a larger percentage of the world that sees the value. I think they've got it wrong. I mean, a lot of times you have large groups of people that gets something wrong. I think they're clouded.
Have you been on The Simpsons yet? Because you have the feeling of that like old guy on The Simpsons just screeching at the wall.
I think as Peter
people,
said,
people's judgment are clouded by dreams of riches from holding a Bitcoin. And the fact that it's gone up in the past, people just assume it's going to keep going up in the future. I think it stopped going up. So we'll see.
In El Salvador, is legal tender. Nobody's using it as a means of payment.
Not yet.
Ask yourself. No, it's been around for years now as a legal tender. Nobody's using it as a means of payment?
I don't care about legal tender.
Answer that question. Why? Since it's so superior, since in 5 seconds you can do everything, it's better than a wire, better than a check, better than a credit card. Why in El Salvador nobody's using Bitcoin for transactions?
I'll tell you why.
Tell me why.
Habit.
I don't know.
Habit.
It's legal.
Habit. Habit. Habits take time to change in the world. It took time for people to get comfortable with the internet. It takes time for people to get comfortable with money that
commercial
doesn't come
air flight,
it
horses,
doesn't come from the central bank.
Telephones.
The average person in El Salvador is worried about how to get like food on their table, right? They're not perusing the Bitcoin forums, understanding about this weird new technology that they can use on their phone. A generation from now, I bet their children will be. But it's not surprising to me that it's not.
Any shop owner in El Salvador may accept, actually, because the legal tender, payment in Bitcoin, but the next moment, you're going to convert it. Because if you keep it overnight, you can lose 10-15% at your profit margin. It's too volatile to be a means of payment. Means of payment is to have stability relative to the price level. Otherwise, that's why you don't like fiat currencies. It cannot be a means of payment. It's never going to be because of this fundamental flaw.
And it can never be a store of value because it doesn't have any value to store. So it fails on every aspect.
Nuril, you have your views. Peter, you have your views, and seemingly you're not going to change your views for anything.
Nothing.
Mooch, you gave
when
us
Jesus
one of
Jesus shows
reasons.
Up, he's going to say, no, I don't like Bitcoin.
You gave us a beautiful closing argument, which then carried on into another debate. When I started this debate tonight, I told you I don't think it's going to be easy. I did tell you that there's four of the strongest personalities in the world, and they are going to debate for and against Bitcoin. I did dub this the biggest Bitcoin debate in history, and I think that having watched most of these debates myself, I think this has been the biggest debate in history in terms of the caliber and the quality of names and production value. For that, of course, I'd like to thank our sponsor. Our big sponsor here is BitLayer. As you know, we did speak about tokenization of assets. Mostly tokenization of assets in DeFi has taken on the Ethereum network. But with sponsors or with people like our sponsors here at BitLayer, those things may actually move to the Bitcoin layer. Because what BitLayer is doing is building a layer 2 on Bitcoin and bringing DeFi and smart contract applications to Bitcoin. If you want to find out more, or if you're a developer, or if you just want to see the 400 projects that are building on BitLayer, just go to bitlayer.org. Once again, it's been a privilege. It's been an honor. It's been the biggest Bitcoin debate, Bitcoin versus gold debate in history. I'd like to thank you guys.
Am I allowed to call them ignorant sluts?
I'd like to thank Nuril. I'd like to thank the folks here at Zero Hedge.
Okay, I love you.
The amazing.
You can have the money in my pocket for that gold bracelet. How's
the
that?
The amazing production.
But you can't have my
you don't have enough in your pocket to afford it.
I do,
so
baby.
I'd like to know. I'm Italian.
I always have singles on.
Gentlemen.
Well, there's over 10,000 worth of gold in that
gentlemen,
bracelet.
I'd like to thank the team, the Zero H team, the production team, the sponsors. I'd like to thank you all. And of course, lastly, and most importantly, I'd like to thank you guys, our audience, for making this all possible. We'll see you guys again soon. Until then, pick your sides, my friends.
A bunch of BS. We're getting ready for another big dump. It's all about pump and then dump.
And they're not even assets. They don't have income. They don't have use.
I still think the bull market is intact for Bitcoin.
It is radical. It is rebellious. It's non-compliant. It's American.